is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, December 2nd, 2005. I'm Chris Andre,
and I'm Becca Barlson.
Coming up on KBOO Morning News, Senator Smith says he will oppose major cuts to Medicaid and food stamp programs. Republicans attempt to create a federal agency exempt from public scrutiny. And police open fire on voters in Egypt. Today's Portland area weather. Today, showers and isolated thunderstorms with small hail. Snow level 1,000 feet with light snow accumulations. Highs 40 to 45. Tonight, showers, slight chance of thunderstorms. Early snow level 500 feet. Snow accumulations less than an inch. Lows 30 to 35.
Members of the Yakima Nation say they may vote next week on whether to pursue opening a tribal casino at Cascade Locks. The Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs are trying to put an off-reservation casino 40 miles east of Portland, and the Cowlitz Tribe wants one in La Center, Washington, about 16 miles north of Portland. The Grand Ronde Tribe's Spirit Mountain Casino, 60 miles west of Portland, already is the state's largest tourist attraction. The Yakima Herald Republic said the tribes also are looking at possible sites in Washington at Tri-Cities, Snoqualmie, and Ellensburg. An Oregon City location could cause problems. Oregon policy limits each of Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes to one casino, generally on reservation or restored land. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Gordon Smith says he will oppose a budget bill before Congress if it includes massive cuts to the Medicaid and food stamp programs. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. The opposition by Smith and other GOP senators to the cuts in the 2006 Budget Reconciliation Act could be a factor in how the final version emerges. Smith says he thinks the 6 Republican senators who also oppose the cuts will hold their positions. House Republican leaders passed a version of the bill that would slash about $50 billion over 5 years with steep cuts in Medicaid and the food stamp program. About 15,000 households out of the 220,000 that receive food stamps in Oregon would be cut under that version. In the Senate, Smith has helped write a version that would cut the budget by about $36 billion over 5 years with mild effects on Medicaid and no direct effect on food stamp spending. That version of the budget bill passed the Senate by only 5 votes, meaning Smith and his 6 allies could hold the balance of power. A joint conference committee is scheduled to reconcile differences in the 2 versions. Any compromise legislation emerging from the conference committee would have to clear both houses to become law.
A grove of ancient redwood trees continues to be logged in Northern California near the town of Scotia. On Wednesday, protesters attempted to block the gates at Maxam Corporation's Pacific Lumber Company when logging trucks were entering the site early this morning. 4 people stood at one gate and 5 at the other. A truck full of loggers approached the gate that had a single person standing in front of it. There were 3 other activists present who stood to the side offering moral support. But the single person in front of the truck finally moved away after the driver intentionally tapped her with the vehicle and then got out and threatened the lone woman blocking his path. In addition to the devastating environmental costs of this cut, there are social costs to the people of Scotia and the viability of long-term work in the area. The company is no longer owned locally after a hostile takeover by the Texas-based Maxim Corporation 20 years ago. If you would like to get away for the weekend, come to California. It's urgent that activists from all over the region come to Scotia to block the loggers from getting to the grove. Please call the hotline number 707-825-6598 to leave a message.
Estimated costs of a Hanford treatment plant to seal radioactive waste in glass could soar $4 billion, according to a closely guarded report by the Army Corps of Engineers. Mismanagement and other problems with cleanup of radioactive pollution at Hanford Nuclear Weapons Factories means the effort could cost as much as 67% more than first estimated. It could also take 4 years longer than promised. The study focused on construction of a plant to seal radioactive waste in glass. The process is a key step in cleaning up one of the world's most polluted sites. It also might not be completed until 2015 instead of the 2011 deadline originally promised. The U.S. Department of Energy has refused to release the full report to state officials, a citizen oversight panel, the media, and even some members of Congress, including Washington Senator Maria Cantwell. The report was leaked to the Seattle Times after months of unsuccessful efforts to get the department to release it under open records laws. Critics of the cleanup efforts say the new information contained in the report is but the latest example of serious blunders at Hanford. The project has already been delayed for years and dogged by missteps, huge cost increases, and technical glitches.
Events in a number of cities throughout the U.S. yesterday commemorated the 50th anniversary of the arrest of civil rights activist Rosa Parks. Chuck Rosina reports from Boston.
Yo, we had a moment of silence for Rosa. Now let's make some noise for Rosa.
A crowd of 700 marched from Roxbury to downtown Boston today to honor Rosa Parks and declare today Rosa Parks Human Rights Day. The crowd grew as it moved through the streets of Boston on its way to a downtown afternoon rally. The main theme of the march was ending poverty, racism, and war, and demanding troops be brought home now, and dignity for Hurricane Katrina survivors, and jobs at living wages. I am Chuck Rosina, reporting for Free Speech Radio News from the streets of Boston.
You may soon be able to carry some scissors and screwdrivers when you fly. The head of the Transportation Security Administration is expected to announce plans to change what will be prohibited from carry-on luggage. Officials say some sharp objects, including scissors less than 4 inches long and wrenches and screwdrivers less than 7 inches long, would be allowed. TSA Chief Kip Hawley is also expected to announce changes for the airport screening process. The changes have drawn fire from the Flight Attendants Union as well as families of 9/11 hijacking victims. Massachusetts Congressman Edward Markey says he'll introduce a bill that would prohibit passengers from carrying anything that's sharp or has a blade. Markey says the TSA should be taking items out of the terrorist toolbox.
A convicted murderer was put to death today in the nation's 1,000th execution since capital punishment resumed in 1977. Kenneth Lee Boyd, who was convicted of killing his estranged wife and father-in-law, received a lethal injection and was pronounced dead at 2:15 a.m. The execution of Kenneth Boyd has not made this a better or safer world, said his attorney, Thomas Mayer. If the 1,000th execution is a milestone, it's a milestone we should all be ashamed of. In his final words, Boyd asked his daughter-in-law to take care of his son and grandchildren and said, "God bless everybody in here." His death came after both Governor Mike Easley and the U.S. Supreme Court declined to intervene and stop the execution.
United Press International reports that the U.S. general, who used to head the National Security Agency, says the only way to stabilize the Middle East is to leave Iraq. Retired three-star Lieutenant General William Odom wrote that while President Bush wants to bring democracy and stability to the Middle East, the only way to achieve that goal is for the U.S. armed forces to get out of Iraq now. Odom's comments first appeared on NiemannWatchdog.org. Odom is one of the most respected U.S. military analysts and a prominent figure at the conservative Hudson Institute in Washington. He wrote, "We have seen most of our allies stand aside and engage in Schadenfreude over our painful bog down in Iraq. There is no chance that our allies will join us in Iraq. It is the worst place to fight a battle for regional stability. Whose interests were best served by the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the first place? It turns out that Iran and Al-Qaeda benefited the most, and that continues to be true every day U.S. forces remain there." Odom's words of warning come at a time when military personnel in Iraq say that morale is at an all-time low.
By creating a federal agency shielded from public scrutiny, some lawmakers think they can speed the development and testing of new drugs and vaccines needed to respond to a bioterrorist attack or superflu pandemic. The proposed Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Agency, or BARDA, would be exempt from long-standing open records and meeting laws that apply to most government departments. This according to legislation approved October 18th by the Senate Health Committee. Republican backers of the bill say the exemptions would streamline the development process, safeguard national security, and protect the proprietary interests of drug companies. The legislation also proposes giving manufacturers immunity from liability in exchange for their participation in the public-private effort. On the other hand, critics point out that public input is essential to make large drug manufacturers continue to take responsibility for their products. The agency would provide the funding for development of treatments and vaccines to protect the United States from natural pandemics, as well as chemical, biological, and radiological agents.
Thousands of janitors in Houston are celebrating their vote to fight for better wages and health care through a union contract. This from KPFT, Renee Feltz has more.
A mariachi band helped celebrate the vote by about 5,000 of 7,000 janitors to unionize. Most Houston janitors are Hispanic women who help support low to moderate income households.
Buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Flora Aguilar. Today I am very proud to say we did it. Houston janitors have won our union.
The final votes to become members of the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, will be certified this week. Janitors who clean Houston's office buildings generally work part-time, lack benefits, and make $5.50 an hour. They hope the SEIU can change that.
We want our children to get care in a doctor's office instead of spending so much time in an emergency room.
The janitor's next step is to negotiate an area-wide master contract. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz at KPFT in Houston.
The first deliveries of cheap Venezuelan heating oil to cash-strapped Massachusetts residents will not arrive for weeks. But the deal involving President Hugo Chavez already is generating political heat on both sides. Venezuela's state-owned oil company ran full-page ads yesterday in two major U.S. newspapers. The ads in the Washington Post and the New York Times came a day after the Wall Street Journal scolded Representative William Della Hunt, Democrat of Massachusetts, and former Representative Joe Kennedy for their cooperation with Chavez. Chavez's critics contend the oil deal is a cynical ploy to score public relations points and tweak the Bush administration. Venezuela's Citgo Petroleum Corporation promoted its plan to offer 12 million gallons of cut-rate oil this winter with the headline, "How Venezuela is Keeping the Home Fires Burning in Massachusetts." Della Hunt and Kennedy, whose Citizens Energy Corporation will help deliver the oil, counter that keeping poor people warm is their priority.
One man was killed and dozens injured as Egyptian security forces used tear gas and live bullets in clashes that marred yesterday's final round of voting in parliamentary elections. This from the UK's Telegraph. In what appeared to be an attempt to counter a strong showing by the opposition Muslim Brotherhood, police stopped voters reaching polling stations across the country. There were claims that officers beat up four judges working as election monitors. At several polling stations, crowds claiming they were being denied the right to vote surged towards the police lines and officers opened fire. One particularly determined group stormed a station using ladders to scale the perimeter wall. The police obstruction will be an embarrassment to America. The U.S. is one of Egypt's strongest allies. Policemen shooting voters does not sit easily with President Bush's avowed support for democracy across the Middle East. But while the death was the third during this election campaign, the bloodshed is considerably less than the last parliamentary election in Egypt when 10 people died. Opposition officials said the police violence showed that the government of President Hosni Mubarak was worried by the success of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood, which has 15 seats in the last parliament, has won 76 so far, but is unlikely to threaten the 200-plus seats expected for the ruling National Democratic Party.
South Africa's highest court ruled yesterday that same-sex marriages enjoyed the same legal status as those between men and women. The move effectively makes the nation one of just five worldwide that has removed legal barriers to gay and lesbian unions. But the Constitutional Court effectively stayed its ruling for 1 year to give the national parliament time to amend a 1961 marriage law to reflect its decision. Should the legislature balk, the law will be automatically changed to make its provisions sex-neutral. Few expect Parliament to resist, even though African nations are generally intolerant of gay relationships and many South Africans are conservatives on social issues. Among political factions here, only the tiny African Christian Democratic Party, whose positions carry a strong religious undercurrent, called for a constitutional amendment that would overturn the legality of gay marriages. The African National Congress was silent on the court's decision. Some religious organizations and one political party dissented bitterly. But homosexuality here is not the sort of burning social issue that has driven some movements like American political conservatives. South African gays have recently won a series of court rulings extending to homosexuals the rights and protections afforded other citizens, this according to the New York Times.
The legal framework of the Kyoto Protocol has been formally adopted by the ongoing United Nations Conference to determine the future of the environmental treaty. For Free Speech Radio News, Elise Hugues reports from Montreal.
The Kyoto Protocol has now become legally binding after parties to the treaty formally approved the agreement yesterday in Montreal. The treaty aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to below 1990 levels. Some environmentalists say this target is too low to combat the effects of global warming, which could result in rising ocean levels, irregular weather, drought, and famine. Ratified by 55% of the world's nations last February, many countries have been unable to meet their commitments without a legal mechanism to enforce the standards. As the UN negotiations continue until December 9th, environmental groups are holding parallel events in Montreal to highlight the responsibility of citizens in combating climate change. They say that poor people will pay the highest cost of the effects of global warming, signaling the recent Gulf Coast hurricanes and last December's tsunami. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Elise Hugues in Montreal.
Dela Melis, the head of the UN investigation into the death of a former Lebanese prime minister, plans to leave the job by the end of the year. Melis intends to submit a report to the UN Security Council on December 12th. After the 12th, he will speak to the 15-nation body as his last official UN task. He will not come to Vienna next week, along with members of his team, to interview five Syrian officials in the assassination after an agreement with Damascus that the questioning could take place outside of Syria. In October, he submitted an interim report that cast suspicion on senior Syrian officials and suggested the assassination was planned by top security officials in Damascus and their Lebanese allies. The Security Council has warned Syria to cooperate with the investigation or face the prospect of further action.
In Britain, the racist thugs who ambushed and murdered Anthony Walker were given life sentences yesterday that will keep them in prison until they are approaching middle age. Paul Taylor was told that he would serve a minimum of 24 years before being considered for parole. His accomplice, Michael Burton, will serve at least 18 years. Anthony and his cousin Marcus Spins had been taunted at a bus stop in Houghton, Merseyside, simply because they were black. The judge made it clear that both killers had made a conscious decision to take the murder weapon with them to the scene.
Tony Blair faced a storm of criticism from the EU's poorest members last night, according to The Telegraph. Blair tried to persuade them to give up £10 billion in funding to secure an EU budget favoring richer countries. Blair flew to Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, and then to Budapest for tense meetings with leaders of seven ex-communist nations. Even before he arrived in Hungary, his gamble appeared to have backfired. It so offended and poisoned public opinion that new member states could not back his proposal. The British Prime Minister was preparing to give up parts of the British rebate, notably elements that related to spending on the new EU members. Those parts of the rebate will be on the table even if UK fails to win a pledge from other EU leaders to reform the common agricultural policy. Britain had foregone some rebate payments from accession countries in a policy dating back to 1999.
The European Union is set to recognize Ukraine as a market economy, according to Al Jazeera. The move should improve trade relations between Europe and the former Soviet state. British Prime Minister Tony Blair and José Manuel Barroso, President of the EU Commission, praised Kiev's liberal leadership. They said that market status was a critical stage in fulfilling an action plan that Ukraine hopes will eventually lead to full EU membership. Blair predicted that the measure would be followed by admission early next year to the World Trade Organization. Further talks are expected to ease visa regulations and start negotiations on a free trade deal. Yushchenko has kept membership of EU and NATO his main focus despite a turbulent first year in office since winning election on a wave of Orange Revolution protests against poll fraud. Yushchenko said the country's aim was EU integration. He said, we will do everything so that within the framework of the strategic aim, European Union citizens will see no new problems with Ukrainian membership, but rather new advantages.
Nearly 3 weeks after the explosion of a chemical plant that polluted a major river in northern China, local authorities are asking for help to cope with the public health and environmental implications. SSRN's Severine Bardot reports from Beijing.
The 50-mile-long leak of toxic benzene that polluted the Songhua River after the November 13th explosion of a petrochemical plant has now poured into the Heilong River and is expected to reach the Russian city of Khabarov in about 10 days. After a formal apology to Russia last weekend, Chinese authorities are now offering the neighboring country monitoring equipment and help to train Russian personnel in dealing with the massive pollution. China has requested an international scientific team composed of World Health Organization and United Nations Development Program members to evaluate the situation in Harbin. Their task will be to provide technical expertise in the area of water and chemical contamination, as well as to study the public health implications, according to a WHO spokesperson in Beijing. Scientists estimate that 70 more cities and about a million people will be affected by the toxic spill downstream in Russia. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Beijing.
Iraqi resistance fighters attacked a U.S. base and a local government building with mortars and rockets in the western Iraqi city of Ramadi yesterday. Scores of heavily armed men set up roadblocks at major entrance and exit points to the city, a heartland of the insurgency in Iraq. They patrolled the main thoroughfares, residents reported. In some areas, they dispersed after a few hours, but guerrillas remained in other parts. Leaflets were distributed and posted on walls saying Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the group led by Jordanian militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, was taking over the city. The assault on Ramadi, capital of Anbar province, began early yesterday with a mortar and rocket attack on a U.S. base in the city and on a nearby provincial governor's building. Ramadi has long been a focal point of militant activity in Iraq. The assault came the day after President Bush announced details of his strategy in Iraq. Bush said more efforts would be made to train Iraqi security forces to take on insurgents so that U.S. forces could eventually withdraw. Judging from recent attacks, many people say Iraqis are doing a solid job of holding off occupation forces.
The Iraqi government says it has banned all foreign Arabs from entering the country as part of security measures for the upcoming parliamentary election. Senior officials say the ban covers all entry points, including airports, border crossings, and ports. One official says the ban is open-ended, but another says it is in place until just after the December 15th vote. Iraq took strict security measures for voting in January and October, but this is the first time that Arabs have been banned altogether for an extended period. U.S. and Iraqi officials blame foreign Arabs for much of the country's violence. Most of those militants are believed to enter illegally across thinly guarded desert borders. An official says the ban doesn't apply to ethnic Arabs with passports from the U.S. or other non-Arabic countries.
Two of America's allies in Iraq are withdrawing forces this month, and a half dozen others are debating possible pullouts or reductions, increasing pressure on Washington as calls mount to bring home U.S. troops. Bulgaria and Ukraine will begin withdrawing their combined 1,250 troops by mid-December. If Australia, Britain, Italy, Japan, Poland, and South Korea reduce or recall their personnel, more than half of the non-American forces in Iraq could be gone by next summer. Japan and South Korea help with reconstruction, but Britain and Australia provide substantial support forces, and Italy and Poland train Iraqi troops and police. Their exodus would deal a blow to American efforts to prepare Iraqis to take over the most dangerous peacekeeping tasks and craft an eventual U.S. exit strategy. Terence Taylor of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Washington said, "The vibrations of unease from within the United States clearly have had an impact on public opinion elsewhere. Public opinion in many of these countries is heavily divided. In the months after the March 2003 invasion, the multinational force numbered about 300,000 soldiers from 38 countries, 250,000 from the U.S. and 50,000 from other countries. The coalition has steadily unraveled as the death toll rises and angry publics clamor for troops to leave."
Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafari will visit Japan next week, according to Reuters. The Japanese Foreign Ministry announced the move a day after local media reported that Tokyo was planning to extend a troop dispatch to help rebuild Iraq. Prime Minister Koizumi faces a decision on whether to prolong Japan's dispatch of around 550 ground troops to Somalia and southern Iraq beyond December 14th. That is when the current mandate for their humanitarian and reconstruction mission expires. While officials say no decision has been made, media reported that Japan planned to lengthen the mandate for its military mission by another year and that it hoped to reach a decision next week. While the Japanese troops do not take part in operations to maintain security, the development in Japan's riskiest overseas military mission since World War II. Japan's troop deployment won praise from Washington, but it is opposed by most Japanese. In a newspaper poll published in October, 77% of those surveyed said they were against an extension.
And finally, cows belching and breaking wind cause methane pollution, but British scientists say they have developed a diet to make pastures smell like roses. Biochemist John Wallace told Reuters, "In some experiments we get a 70% decrease in methane emissions, which is quite staggering." Wallace is the leader of the microbial biochemistry group at Rowett Research Institute in Aberdeen. He says the secret to sweeter-smelling cows is a food additive based on fumaric acid. Fumaric acid is a naturally occurring chemical essential to respiration of animal and vegetable tissues. A 12-month commercial and scientific evaluation of the additive has just begun. If it proves successful, it could be a boon to cutting down on greenhouse gas emissions. Scientists in Australia and New Zealand have also been working to develop similar products amid growing concern about greenhouse gas emissions from cattle and sheep.
That was the KBOO Morning News for Friday, December 2nd, 2005. Portland area weather today. Today, showers and isolated thunderstorms with small hail, snow level 1,000 feet with light snow accumulations, highs 40 to 45. Tonight, showers, a slight chance of thunderstorms early, snow level 500 feet, snow accumulations less than an inch, lows 30 to 35. Saturday, showers likely, highs around 40, lows 30 to 35. And Sunday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, highs 40 to 45, lows around 35. Thanks for joining us for this morning's news. This morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartleson and Chris Andre. Our engineer is Kathleen Stevenson, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Chris Andre.
At 7:30 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, Ani and Melody focus on the Portland Police with their guest, Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. At 9, it's APA Compass, featuring an interview with actress, author, and activist Margaret Cho. Also hear about global issues affecting Asia and Pacific Islander communities. At 10, Per Fogarain interviews Captain James Yee, the former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay Prison and author of For God and Country, Patriotism Under Fire. At 10:30 on Sounds of Awareness, the topic is help for menorrhagia, or severe menstrual symptoms. And 11 is Democracy Now! And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News, featuring a look at a new Vancouver location for the Community Cycling Center. At 5:30, it's Counterspin with a critic of the media from Fairness and Accuracy in Media. Would you like to help out with the morning news? KBOO News volunteers help getting important stories like these out to listeners. Please contact us at amnews@kboo.org or call 503-232-8818, extension 202. This is KBOO, your community radio station, in Portland on 90.7 FM, in Corvallis at 100.7, and in White Salmon area on K220HR at 91.9 FM. Have a lovely weekend.
Every day, but a lot. You know, where are you from?
No, where are you really from?
It happens, and they know me even fast.
I mean, people are just very curious, and I think it's the responsibility of our media to show that we're actually not foreign.
APA Compass, an Asian Pacific American public affairs program. Tune in for features on economic, political, and social justice issues, arts and culture, and APA perspectives.
This time, we look at Cambodian-American communities and the continuing impact of unexploded bombs and mines that the U.S. dropped on Cambodia with the upcoming film premiere, Bomb Hunters. And we'll hear back from Claire Oliveros, who's returned from the International Solidarity Mission in the Philippines. Plus, our interview with comedian, actress, author, and activist, Margaret Cho.
I would really love to be a straight white man just for a weekend because I think it would be so relaxing.
APA Compass, your Asian Pacific American orientation. Now on first Friday of the month, 9 to 10 a.m.
As part of healing the wounds of war, Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange are coming to share their experiences at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228 in Smith Memorial Student Union. Share their experiences, build solidarity, and help achieve justice for these Vietnamese Agent Orange victims. The event takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. on December 7th. For more information, visit vn-agentorange.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
one of my favorite songs from Lorena McKennitt. That was Marco Polo from one of her recent CDs. I think it's called The Visit. A wonderful song. A way to sort of get you all fired up on this very cold and wet and gloomy Friday morning. But that's okay, you know. Gloomy is good. It's a good day to curl up on the sofa with a cup of tea or stay in bed with the cat on your chest and listen to KBOO. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Melody Silverwolf, and my lovely co-host Ani Haynes is here as well. And this morning we are joined by our most frequent guest throughout the course of our show, Dan Handelman from the Oregon Peace and Justice Works and from CotWatch. And he's going to be talking to us about police issues and the issue of the Perez report about the shooting of Mr. Perez. And before we begin, we have a couple of announcements, and one of them is live and in person. Woohoo! So first, the one that isn't live and in person. This is an announcement about International Human Rights Day, which is on December 10th. They're going to be heating up the fight to restore workers' freedom to reform unions. And it's a fight against the WTO, which is going to be meeting in Hong Kong the 13th through the 18th of December. And the whole corporate trade agenda, you know the deal. So there's a whole bunch of people endorsing it, as usual. You know the spiel. Time to show up with march around and make your wishes known. There's a rally and march to support the right to organize and say no to the WTO on Saturday the 10th. It's at noon, Southwest First and Salmon. And then also a concomitant event is the International Fair Trade Teach-In. It's at PSU Koinonia Center, which is at the corner of Broadway and Montgomery. And that's on the 17th, which is the Saturday after that, from 10 to 4. And if you need more information about all of this, you could call Oregon Peace and Justice Works at 236.
Jobs with Justice.
Jobs with Justice. All right. And unfortunately, they did not put their number.
236-5573.
Thank you. Would you repeat that?
236-5573.
Awesome. Okay, for more information. Otherwise, December 10th at noon, First and Salmon, support unions, say no to the WTO, both very worthy causes.
But wait, there's more. There's also a house concert tomorrow night, Joanne Rand, with her band, The Rhythm of the Open Hearts, and it's a house concert near Selwood. It's tomorrow night at 8 p.m., and if you want more information about that, the number is 503-234-6308. And then there is also Kathy Kelly. You know, Kathy Kelly, Voices in the Wilderness, amazing activist, organizing kind of person, is appearing at the Miller Library, Portland State, and that's tonight at 7 o'clock. Donations of canned food for the Oregon Food Bank will be accepted at the door, but otherwise there is no charge. That's Kathy Kelly again tonight, 7 o'clock, Miller Library, PSU.
Fab. And now, da-da-da-da-da, for our live and in-person announcement.
Well, we wanted to perhaps even back it up a little bit more than that. We have with us many things going on. We have Brenna and Brush from the Try On Life Community Farm. And we are excited to have announcements, news, and updates from the struggle to actually get the farm into community hands and secured. So what's going on with that? What's the update?
Well, thanks so much, Ani. And it really is an exciting process. This last year, as many listeners will know, this 7-acre sustainability education and demonstration center out in Southwest Portland has really just flourished. People have come from all over the area, from our local neighbors right in the, in the streets around us, to people from throughout Portland, and even from Astoria and from Southern Oregon and from other parts of the country come through, and are really just inspired by the opportunity to create here inside the city on a bus line, half an hour by bike from downtown, a real thriving model of what an urban paradigm could be like if we were to really transform our relationship with the earth. And that's really what it's about for us, is having an opportunity to create a little taste, a model, an experience of what another world is like and could be like here inside the city. And, you know, the campaign has been a long one, and, you know, a lot of people thought it was impossible to come up with $1.5 million. And it's been just an absolute inspiration to see people coming together. You know, it's a different kind of organizing, perhaps, than we've had experience with in the past. It's not fighting against things, which is important and critical, but it's a different kind of a recognition. It's a recognition that, you know, we may not be people with billions of dollars to, you know, flush in any direction at the flick of a button, but we are able, when we come together, you know, and divert, you know, small but significant mm-hmm. chunks of our daily and monthly money towards something we all believe in, we're really able to make an enormous difference. And to watch, you know, students who, you know, save $20 a month, you know, for 5 months and give us $100, mm-hmm. Which is, on the one hand, a large donation, and on the other hand, you know, almost many people can really contribute that kind of money. And when we do it together, 2,000 people, you know, all the listeners on this show, that's the money that we need, $200,000.
You know, there are so many people out there listening who could make a significant contribution to this, $10, $50, $100. And I suspect there's a few people listening who could easily give $10,000 or $50,000 without even missing it. This is a nonprofit organization. It's tax deductible. December 31st is almost upon us. Think long and hard about it. Those of you who have some money who are listening to this announcement, think about really giving generously. You couldn't go wrong.
Brenda, go ahead, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about how things really recently have been going, what efforts you have right now, and how people can connect with you.
Sure. Like Brush said, it's been a really inspiring process. We have now, you know, there's so much that's going on. Some of the really exciting things are the fact that the City of Portland and Metro have both gone on board and are planning on contributing $100,000 each to a conservation
Excellent.
Movement across the land. The kind of last stickler in the government agencies is the state parks. And they're our next-door neighbor. We're surrounded on three sides by state parks. So one thing that people can do is write to the State Parks Commission, and care of the director, whose name is Tim Wood, and encourage them to contribute, to join the city and Metro in contributing to the conservation easement.
And is all this information on your website?
It is indeed Good. On our website. The website, by the way, is www.tryonfarm.org. It's T-R-Y-O-N farm.org. We're also having a large solstice benefit gathering on December 17th. It's a very different kind of experience than you usually get in the city, being that there's woods and a bonfire and bands in the barn and acoustic music and performance poetry in the house. That information's also on the website. So this is our final push. If we can get the last $200,000, the land will be protected in perpetuity as part of the Oregon Sustainable Agriculture Land Trust, and we'll continue our education programs. If not, we'll probably go back on the market to become a housing development. So again,
it would be so sad.
It is, and it's been so inspiring to see the reaction from the Portland community. So we just encourage people, if you've ever heard of us and thought, maybe I'd like to contribute, now is the time.
This would be a good,
this would be a good
moment.
Time.
All right. Well, again, Brenna and Brush, thank you so much. For
and do you have a telephone number in case people don't have web access?
We do. Our telephone number is 503-245-3847. Again, the website is tryonfarm.org.
And the event is on the 17th of December, and it's going to be a perfect time of year to get out and, you know, celebrate community around the bonfire. What could be a better thing to do?
Thanks so much for having us on the show.
Thanks for coming on, and we really wish you the best, and let's hope the next time we see you, you're going to be telling us how great it is that you made your goal.
Yay.
Woo!
Thanks.
All right, thanks a lot. Thank you for coming.
So we now shift gears from the... That was a wonderful moment of community pulling together, and we can all feel really good, and we need to continue to feel good that direction, too. Gosh and golly, Dan.
We sure do have a lot of work to do in some parts of the community, don't we?
Yeah, but we can still feel good.
But we can still feel good about actually a number of things that are happening. And, well, again, Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch.
Yes,
thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank
we
you.
Shift gears now to looking at Portland Police. And what's happening in the ever-exciting world of watching what the Portland Police are doing.
Right. Well, you know, we have had some victories this year around Portland Police issues. including, for one thing, the Joint Terrorism Task Force victory, where they were removed from, the two officers were removed from the Joint Terrorism Task Force from Portland Police. That was good. And we also had the departure of the rather, micromanaging director of the Police Review Board, Richard Rosenthal, and he's gone to Denver now. So those are good things. We otherwise have a lot of other struggles ahead of us. I don't know how many people could hear what I just said.
He said that they have a lot of other struggles ahead of them. There, we're trying to change microphones without being
subtly. Thank you. Thank you for being so subtle. Anyway, so one of the things, I mean, obviously, we're this week two major things came out of the police bureau. That's why you called me here.
Right.
It is
what has brought us together again today.
But there's also an ongoing struggle going on where there seems to be a lot of motion in the right direction, which is the efforts to modify or get rid of the drug-free zones, which I don't know how much people are familiar with those. So I want to make sure we talk about that a little bit, too.
That'll be a really good part of this conversation. But let's go ahead and talk first about what is coming out of the police department this week. There's been a couple of, I think, what looks to be kind of significant moves in the face of reports coming out. Go ahead and just start filling us in, Dan.
Well, there's actually not a lot of movement because of these reports. The reports are, well, let me just start. James Jahar Perez was shot in March of 2004 by Officer Jason Seary and tasered subsequently for 3 minutes by his partner, Sean Maycomber. Well, was his partner that day anyway. And the community was quite upset about this. This was less than a year after Kendra James was shot. Mm-hmm. Both of them were unarmed African-American young people. And there were people in the streets, and there was a lot of pressure on the police to clean up their act. There was a public inquest for the first time in, 20 years almost, mm-hmm. Around this case, but it happened after the grand jury had already met. But as a result, we got to see a lot of the inner workings of the police bureau. We got to hear Officer Seary on the stand explain why he did what he did. And I think ultimately the pressure of the community outcry caused him to resign. But all of this happened long before this report came out. Meanwhile, there was a report that came out through the so-called Independent Police Review Division, the IPR, called the Park Report, named after the company that did the report. And it was about how police in Portland could clean up their shootings and deaths in custody, investigations mostly. There's very little in the report about how to prevent shootings. Most of it's about how to do better investigations afterwards. So a lot of this report from the Jahar Perez case that Chief Fox was put out on Monday is listing a lot of things that they did as a result of that report, that Park report, which came out months before Jahar Perez was shot. And just repeating these things that we already knew. So this is kind of a waste of paper in that sense. It also has the letter that the grand jury sent explaining how concerned they were that this has happened and Chief Foxworth's response to them, and that they were concerned about the fact that Perez had been pulled over on a pretext stop and it appeared to be some sort of racial profiling, and this had already been published a long time ago. The new news is that the FBI... Foxworth actually invited the FBI. Nobody knows he has a twin brother who's an FBI agent. But anyway, he asked the FBI to do a civil rights investigation, and they finished the investigation, and they're determining whether to prosecute.
So who would they prosecute?
Who would they prosecute?
Yes, exactly.
They might prosecute the individual officers.
For denial of civil rights.
Right, for denying him the civil rights. And I'm not really sure that that's going to happen because that's never happened in Portland. But you never know. So we'll hold out some hope on that for the time being. And then the other things that were in here that I had never seen before are that the training that they do, now they always have a component apparently in every part of the training for officers, I can't remember the word they use now, but for officer disengagement.
Uh-huh.
for officers to back off in some situations.
Yeah, sort of a de-escalation. Yes.
Right.
Sometimes less is more.
Right. Well, the thing is, we tried to use the word de-escalation for a long time to tell them how they should redo their training, and it turns out that de-escalation to them means you put away your gun and you take out your taser. So de-escalation to them is just coming down the continuum of force one step. Whereas for us, like, de-escalation means let's talk about using words, you know, go stand in the corner, have a timeout,
yeah, right. De-escalation,
maybe back off.
Yeah, like, you know, you have on your bulletproof vest, you come up to the car, you say, all right, sir, you step out, let's have a talk, or what's going on, you know, instead of, like, stabbing him with a taser.
For example. Right. So, but the fact that you're using the term disengagement is very encouraging because that means that maybe we're starting to talk the same language, at least somewhat. Unless disengagement has a different meaning, too.
you never know.
Yeah. It's escaping me now what the third piece of information was, but I remember it was something that was relatively good. I'm sure I'll think of it during the course of this interview.
It'll come back. We are continuing to have just a little bit of mic trauma this morning, so forgive us as we adjust.
That was kind of my high school mic.
I took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say, yeah, he used to live next door to me.
Same guy.
Hey, cool.
I think that it's interesting that, again, you know, there's not a lot of new information, but at the same time, there's another chance to focus on changes the police department have made. And I agree, whereas, you know, they may have not made them since the Perez, you know, inquest, the fact that there have been changes implemented, I think that's something that we can talk about for a moment and just sort of, again, if you could give us an overview of what kind of changes over the last, you know, 2-3 years, the Portland police have really been under some scrutiny. There was, you know, this pretty horrible track record of police shootings for several years running. It was pretty phenomenal. And again, we've had another recent shooting, and I want to get around to talking about that as well. But what kind of changes have the police, just if we wanted to give people sort of an overview?
Well, I just want to make it clear that, first of all, Peace and Justice Works is a peace group, and Portland Cop Watch is a project of that peace group. And we want to see, as much as possible, the state not given the power to take away people's lives, whether it's war, the death penalty, or police shootings. And when you said that there was a rash of police shootings in years past, and now it doesn't seem there is. There have been 8 shootings this year.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
In the last 2 years, there were 4 shootings each year. And now they get tasers in the hands of every officer. We were promised the tasers would be used to help reduce the number of shootings, and yet the number of shootings had doubled. So that's kind
corrected.
Of disappointing.
No, you're totally
how many
right.
of those shootings were fatal?
I don't have the number on the top of my head, but it was not all of them. There were several incidents where the bullets did not kill the people, at least 2, and the third one where the bullet didn't hit the suspect and actually hit somebody's house. So, but nonetheless, it was a shooting incident involving the police.
Yes.
I can't count that.
What? And it seems to me, you know, I'm hoping that maybe something that might come out of this Perez report is a change in the training procedures of the police, because it seems to me that that's really the crux of the biscuit, is that these officers are trained in such a way that this is the logical outcome of their training,
right.
the way they behave. And obviously the training must change for them to behave differently in the field.
Right. So let's getting back to Ani's question, which is tied to your point that you just made, Melody, is that the Park Report asked the Bureau to change, for instance, the preface to their deadly force directive, what's called the directive. It used to be called general orders. And they added something about the sanctity of life to that. But it didn't go as far as other cities where they said that shooting should always be the last resort. And so they kind of went halfway. A lot of these recommendations kind of went halfway. They cleaned up their investigations to some extent, where they used to wait as long as 4 days before they interviewed the officers. Now they've been interviewing the officers within 24, sometimes 48 hours if there's a holiday or some other snafu. But that's not actually policy right now. It's just happening because the police union felt the pressure.
Isn't that rather unusual, though? I mean, I was under the impression that the desirable procedure would be to interview the officer ASAP.
Yes, it is. And actually, that's what it says. in the directives to do it as soon as possible, but as soon as possible with a union contract that allows you to have a lawyer and a union representative means you get to go home and call them and, you know, get up the next day after you've got your story straight.
That's a big problem.
Right. They also have strengthened the provisions that make it so that officers can't talk to each other before getting interviewed. And we know that in the Kendra James case, that was a big problem.
Right, the Applebee's dinner.
Yeah, we keep getting pre-product placement to that restaurant. But, yes, they met at a restaurant. and we don't know if they talked about the case, but it's highly unlikely they did not because it was probably a pretty big event for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you're involved in a shooting incident. You're not really going to go and, you know, talk about the opera.
But maybe they didn't talk about anything that would be compromising, but we don't really know.
Right, right. And there's other things, too. Last summer, after the Perez shooting, the community, kind of led by the Albina Ministerial Alliance, put forward a proposed community policing resolution to the city council that said, we want better training around racial profiling issues, we want less shootings, and we want a new review board. And Mayor Katz and Commissioner Francesconi, who both are since gone, argued over who should present the resolution to council. They stripped everything about the review board off of there. Gary Blackmore, who runs the review board, must have incredible amounts of power over the rest of the city council, I have to tell you.
Wouldn't you like to know why?
Well, I think I can figure out why. you want your things audited? I can audit your departments if you want
me to.
Well,
I mean, that's obviously...
there's always that.
I mean, that's you know, everybody should be audited on a regular basis.
I agree.
It's part of government.
I agree. So, you know, I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, they're deadly afraid of talking about the review board. And there's we can get back to that, too, but there's a committee being set up to hire somebody to look at the review board, and then they're going to maybe talk to the community about what our concerns are, but write some kind of professional report. So even though we, the community, help make the review board, we're not going to help say whether it's adequate. It's just a ridiculous thing.
That's special.
Right. In any case, this resolution, do you have to announce what this
resolution
is?
Yes, we do. Da-da-da.
It's 8 o'clock in the morning. You're listening to KBOO-FM, Portland.
Yes, you are indeed. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Our guest is Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch. Our phone number, 503-231-8187. And we do have a caller.
Yeah, Dan, did you want to finish?
I just want to finish the thought about the resolution. So the resolution ultimately passed and called for, among other things, better recruiting efforts for, I think, I can't remember the word they used because minority isn't necessarily true for people of color in this country at this point, but to recruit more people of color, to do more training around de-escalation and racial profiling issues, and to change the rules about shooting so that made it more restricted. And the chief has responded to some of those and increased the amount of training, but there's like 2 hours of what's called cultural competency training.
And so in 2 hours, you're supposed to unlearn all the things you've learned growing
racism,
up in this culture?
Right. So it's inadequate, but there are steps being taken.
All right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in, and we do have some callers lined up and ready to go, so we want to give you a chance to talk here this morning on KBOO, ask Dan questions, discuss police issues, and good morning. Good morning to our first caller. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. Good morning, Dan. How are you doing?
Just fine.
So I've been following the police shootings for quite some time, and I've been at numerous protests where I've seen the police come out in their robo gear and stuff. And the thing that really strikes me is that really the cops are afraid.
Yep.
Yes. It seems to me that anybody that is afraid is going to do bad things and think that it's justifiable to do those bad things. And I wonder if another track on this issue is to really figure out what the police are afraid of and finding ways that the community can come together and mitigate that fear.
I think that's an excellent idea, actually.
Yes.
And the thing that was most interesting about seeing Officer Siri testify at the inquest was that they showed his training tape where he went up to a car and somebody had a gun under their seat as part of the training exercise. And he freaked out, ran to the back, and tried shooting at them with his, you know, whatever, I guess, blank-filled gun, and his gun jammed. So he had been trained to that you go up to a car and somebody's going to pull a gun out on you.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's what their training is.
That's what happened in the Perez case, is it not? He said that he claimed that he thought Perez was pulling a gun out.
Right, and he was pulling for his cell phone. So this is exactly what you're saying is true. That I think I've thought about the concept many times that if it would be good for the police to put together some kind of training video to show this is what happens when the police pull you over, because a lot of people don't like getting pulled over. And they'll start mouthing off at a cop, and we try to remind people that even though we disagree with it, police have a lot of power. They have a gun and a badge and a baton and pepper spray and a taser, and they can pretty much do whatever they want, especially when there's no witnesses around. So when you flunk the attitude test, that's a lot of times where this goes wrong. And, you know, basically that's what Jahar Perez did. He rolled up the window when they were trying to talk to him.
Right. And I guess, just to finish what you were saying,
if we also had some kind of communication back toward the police, though, saying, why are you so afraid of the community? I understand that there are people out there that want to do harm to police officers, and I understand that from time to time they do come up to a car and somebody might pull a gun on them. And, you know, we don't advocate for that, but it's rare. They talk about how many calls, they have like 500,000 calls a year, and then they get 800 complaints. So they're saying, why are CopWatch making such a big deal about police misconduct? Well, we know the number of cases of misconduct are much greater than that. That's just the people who bother to file a complaint, mm-hmm. among other things. But the flip side of that is, if there's 400,000 calls a year, how many times does somebody pull a gun on them? Probably roughly the same number of times that they have these complaints filed.
A dozen, maybe.
Yeah, well, probably more than that, but you know, whatever. So we need to, you're right, work on lowering their fear factor.
I think that's a really great point. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to see some kind of community forums or, you know, process set up to have these discussions, especially mm-hmm. in the Northeast and North communities where, you know, so much of this violence has been happening.
Well, and on top of that, if I could interject, I think that there's a lot of fear that comes to dealing with the people. You know, I work in the service industry, and I know that people can just be really rude and unkind. And, you know, and especially, you know, to a policeman, nobody's ever happy to see a cop. And so I would suspect from their perspective, they get a lot of grief and crap, if I can say that on the air, that, you know, mm-hmm. that really they don't deserve. And I can understand why, you know, I've been in a situation where somebody has really been rude and disrespectful and angry and agitated at me for really no reason that had nothing to do with me. And, you know, that sometimes that set with me a day, 2 days.
Sure.
And so I think that really we've got a two-way thing here. Yeah, the cops are definitely shooting us down.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, man, we don't treat them like people.
Well, they also don't participate in our community. The problem is, in my opinion, partly exacerbated by the fact that so many, not all, but a great number of Portland police officers live as far away from Portland as humanly possible, mm-hmm. and still to get here to commute in. Like, they live in Woodland and Mount Hood and Dallas, I mean, Oregon. You know, I mean, like, really far away, as far away. It's like we're so distasteful that they want to live as far away from Portland as they can get on their off time because Portland's so horrible they only want to have to go there just for a little. I mean, that's a problem. I think police officers should live, for the most part, in the community where they work.
Right. I agree. And I think too, part of the problem is race and racism and classism. And, mm-hmm. you know, those are things that get reinforced. I think cops watch cops, and you see the same kinds of people mm-hmm. always being the suspects on that. And there's a lot of unlearning that needs to be done. But I think, too, one of my favorite stories about the WTO was this, I guess there's a big standoff between RoboCops with their helmets on and protesters, and one of the protesters said, hey, let's step back, you guys, why don't you just flip up your visors and take a deep breath? And they did, and apparently, like, all the tension went out of that standoff, and everybody just calmed down, and it's like the most tense story. And that's kind of thing,
cool.
Right, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, we need more of.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Carla. You made some really great points. Well, you know, I think many years ago, the California Highway Patrol, at least, and probably other highway patrols at the time, started wearing those mirrored sunglasses.
Mm.
And that was sort of the first step in the I do not see you, I am separate from you, RoboCop kind of gear. And it's basically like a kind of protection. You can't see my eyes. I'm in control.
Oh, yeah. Whenever I've done clinic escorting, mm-hmm. you know, at abortion-providing centers, I've always worn mirrored glasses.
So you can sort of have that.
There's something to be said.
Barrier between people.
You know, I mean, I can see that.
I think Chief Foxworth got a lot of flack for this, but he tried to introduce a training video for the cops that showed that every time they go up to a car, they say, hello, ma'am or sir, my name is Officer blah blah, and I'm pulling you over because of blah blah. And I don't know why.
Nice.
Right. Apparently, that's how they teach them in the outlying areas of Portland.
It just sort of, it makes sense to approach a situation in that manner.
Yeah, I agree with you.
The last time I had an encounter with a cop, it was a state cop, and I had run out of gas on I-5 some years ago, and he didn't do any of that, but he did come up. He says, what's the problem? Are you out of gas? I said, yes. He goes, well, let me help you. I mean, he never told me his name, but he was quite polite. But I thought that would be a good thing. I think that would be a good way to approach things.
503-231-8187. Good morning to you. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, okay. Hey, I want to say that if you obey the law, you do what you're supposed to do, you're not going to get shot at. Would you agree with that?
Nope. I don't agree with that.
Okay, so if you're out on drugs, you got a gun, you're going to pull a gun. You know, I've been pulled over probably 3 or 4 times in the last 3 years. In fact, I was just pulled over 2 weeks ago because it was my fault, my plates expired. I had a good attitude. I told him I was sorry. I told him what the situation was. He wrote me a warning. He said, thanks for your good attitude, and I went on my way.
Right. Well, that's what we were talking about a minute ago. I don't disagree that for your own safety, it's a good idea.
Of course it is.
Okay, tell me,
be polite when the police pull you over. But I think that doesn't guarantee you that the situation's not going to escalate out of control.
Okay, well, why does the officer escalate the situation, or does the person escalate it?
Sometimes. I mean, I suspect, sir, that you're not an African-American or Latino person.
Oh, come on. Give me a break.
Now, wait a minute.
That's racist.
Have you ever... Tell me something. No, it's not. I suspect. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever read a book? It's quite an old book by now. You ever read a book called Black Like Me?
No, I haven't.
I think you should check it out from the library. It was written back in the late 50s, early 60s about a white gentleman who... Listen to me. Through the artifice of his dermatologist, he was able to pretend to be a black person. He, you know, darkened his skin and lived as a black man for several months and wrote a book about it. And I'll tell you, it's an eye-opening experience. I know many African-American persons who are law-abiding, upstanding citizens, have a job, you know, put their pants on one leg at a time every day, and they get pulled over all the time by the cops for just driving down the street, doing nothing.
Okay, but are they shot and killed?
No, they're not. But they could be at any time.
This guy Perez, who was shot and killed, why was he shot?
Well, that's a good question, because they said they pulled him over because he failed to signal a turn 100 feet before he turned into a parking lot.
Okay, if he would have had his hands on the steering wheel like you're supposed to when an officer comes up.
Right, but that's not the law.
Do you think he would have got shot? No, he wouldn't have.
Maybe not, but I want to be clear. You said if you follow the law, and I don't know that the law says you have to keep your hands on the steering wheel.
It doesn't. You should have
just
shot. That's
the procedure that you have to know. That's the procedure that you are supposed to know, but nobody trains us that. There's no class that you take in school that I know of where it says this is what you're supposed to do.
Have any of you ever been a police officer?
No. I've ridden a lot of police officers.
You ought to go in their shoes and be a police officer for 2-3 years.
I'm glad to do that as soon as those officers like live as a homeless person for a week see what it's like to be on the other side of the night.
Have you ever been an officer, sir, or ridden along with a police officer?
What's that?
Have you ever been an officer or ridden along with police officers?
I have ridden along. My neighbor's a police officer.
I've ridden along. I've ridden along as well, and it was, you know, it was a very different situation in a suburb of Southern California, not Portland. But I think the problem is that there's no... The likelihood of being shot is small, but... The problem is that the police are not adequately trained for their own safety, as well as what about the bystanders in the Perez case? There were people all around. Any one of them could have been shot.
We got to support our police officer. They do a good job. in spite of what they have to face on a day-to-day basis. It's one of the most dangerous jobs you can have, and I think they do a great, overall, they do a great job. Yes, there are some really bad cops out there, but the percentage in compared to the criminals out there is very, very small.
Well, my contention is that the police could be much better trained and that they would be safer, and so would all of us.
Well, let's say they do a good job. Let's back them up, all right?
Well, actually, I think it's important to look at instances where, in fact, the jobs weren't done well because it costcosts people lives.
Yes, it does.
And that's really not appropriate.
And then it endangers the other officers.
Because we have this situation then that occurs where there's this distancing, there's polarization, there's distrust of the officers. In my perfect world, I want to support the officers. I want community policing. I want something that looks like police responding to community needs and the community, including the police, in their day-to-day business. I'd like to see a true partnership, but that's not what I'm seeing. And when you have police officers reacting in great fear because they've been trained that everyone is potentially, absolutely dangerous, when you have that as a focus, it creates an unsafe situation for everyone, including the police.
Well, I see it different. I think they're doing a great job. They're trained well. I never fear them. When I get pulled over, I have nothing to fear.
I just have to say that's probably an act of privilege.
Because I have nothing to hide. And if you've got something to hide, you're going to fear them.
I bet if you went out on a street corner and asked 1,000 Oregonians, do you fear the police? A large proportion of, ordinary middle-class type folks would say they do. And that's not good. That's not good. I think that one of the reasons that they fear the police is because they don't really know what the police are going to do. Many officers are responsible and, behave properly, but some officers are just not, they're not there. They need further training. And I think that it would just behoove everybody if we trained them better and trained them differently.
Well, and I think they're working on it. I think every situation like this, the press situation, forces them or encourages them, for more training. It's not like they shoot somebody, let's just go on. I think they do look at that, and they try to do better.
Well, I agree with you, but we shouldn't.
We're not playing with toy guns here. We're playing with the life of a police officer.
That's right.
We're also playing
with the lives of all community members.
That's right.
I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that you devalue the life of Jahar Perez because he's not a police officer. And I think that you need to think about putting yourself in the shoes of the people who have died and their families and think about that, too. And, I'm sure that Officer Siri has to live with the guilt of this the rest of his life, and that's probably why he's working in a Christian school now, teaching, because he probably can't live with what he did. But I think that there's other people who suffered other than him, and I hope that you think about that, too.
Well, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it.
Let me say, I remember the third new piece of information in the Perez report. The first two I mentioned were that they are using de-escalation, but they're calling disengagement tactics, and that the FBI is investigating. They're done with their investigation, they may prosecute. The other new piece of information is that the police bureau found no wrongdoing through their own policies of either Officer Siri for the shooting or Officer Maycomber for repeatedly cycling his taser for 3 minutes on Perez's dying body.
I thought that was like not the procedure for using a taser.
Well, it's not. In fact, one good piece of news, when I said this morning we can have a little good stuff here and there, is that Chief Foxworth about a month ago issued a bulletin that says if officers are going to be using tasers, they shouldn't use them repeatedly unless they can explain why they pulled the trigger more than once, and that they particularly shouldn't do it if they have the probes across somebody's chest that can restrict somebody's breathing. Right, and we think that's why so many people have died after being tased, even though Taser International says, our product is perfectly safe. There's an SEC investigation into Taser, whether they overestimated how safe their products are, and they lost $1 billion in the stock market and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so Chief Foxworth is recognizing that and starting to restrict it. We'd like to see tasers go away because they're basically being used as implements of torture, but if they're regulating them better, that's a good sign. We still haven't had a taser-related death of a human in Portland. A dog died after getting tased earlier this year.
Well, certainly a taser being, zipped that by a taser would be preferable to being killed by a gun. Before we go to our next caller, I wanted to ask you, there's been a lot of a lot of attention paid this past year to, like, steroids in baseball. And we know that in the past there have been incidents where there was an off-duty Clackamas County sheriff who killed a woman because he was high on steroids. And it's commonly discussed that many people who are required to be in good shape for their job, police officers included, some of them use steroids. Do you think that steroids played a role in any of the behavior of the Portland police?
That's an interesting question. I have no idea. I've actually never heard that specific allegation about the police before, but we do know that they don't have a drug testing policy.
Well, yes,
and I don't know whether steroids would be considered illegal drugs for police officers.
They're tested for in a drug test. That's one of the things when you pee in a cup, that's what they test for.
So I think, and the this is a very important thing for the cable listening audience, by the way. The union, so-called, the Portland Police Association, which is actually not a union, it's an association, a labor bargaining unit, is going to start negotiating their contract with the city in January, and it came out very recently that they don't have a written policy on drug testing. We thought for years that they had something in the contract that specifically said you cannot do drug testing.
That was what we all learned.
Right, but I guess what our supposition was based on the state regulation that if you're going to have a drug testing policy, it has to be bargained with the union. So they're in a position now where they can put forward whatever they want. And I think the community needs to push them to say one of the provisions of that is anytime there's a police discharge of a firearm, regardless of whether it's justified, there should be a drug test.
I think that's reasonable.
And I think that is reasonable, and we have the opportunity to push that now. And for years, people have called on this show and said, well, why don't we have that? And we said, well, the union will never go for it. Well, now they say, oh, we're perfectly happy to have a drug testing policy that's solid and, you know, has probable cause. And I think probable cause, since
discharging a firearm,
yes,
seems like
that's reasonable.
That seems
right. And the district attorney is bringing all these cases to a grand jury as though there may be probable cause for some kind of criminal charge, even though most of the time, 100% of the time, they never find criminal behavior. Well, then let's do a drug test, too.
You know, before we get to another caller, I did want to talk just briefly again about the recent police shooting resulting in death a couple weeks ago. There's the reports of the so-called suicide by police.
Right.
That, you know, there's ever more information coming out about. So can you let folks know about that?
Another tragic situation. And it's hard, you know, we don't see community mobilization around this man because he actually did have a gun. And both Perez and Kendra James were unarmed. And this guy had a gun. He called his friends and said he was thinking about committing suicide, and they called the police. This should make people think twice about when they call the police. And, you know, the gentleman before said, or that he didn't think anybody was happy to see the police. Or maybe that was you, Melody.
No, somebody
said that.
I think
somebody.
It was Melody. Actually.
Maybe it was Melody.
No, I didn't say that.
Anyway.
I didn't say
no,
that.
No, you're right. I think the caller said it. But in any case.
I would never say that. I'd be happy to see the police if somebody had just, like, tried to, like, you know, like,
rape or murder somebody.
Light my house on fire.
Right, exactly. There are situations where you might be happy to see the police. Like, in fact, when you have a car accident, when you're standing by the side of the road, we're having a protest action and they block traffic for us so that we don't get run over by Mack trucks. That's nice.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are things that the police do that are good. But in this case, they came, they set up a perimeter, they had a tactical team, hostage negotiation team, and the CERT team. And they weren't talking to each other, apparently.
Uh-oh.
So the hostage negotiator was talking to this young man, he's 30 years old, Raymond Gorder, on the phone, and trying to tell him, you know, talk to him just about whatever. And apparently, she was talking to him about his dog, and he had been sitting cross-legged in the yard, I don't know if he was cross-legged, he was sitting down in the yard, in a fenced-in yard, and the police sniper, whose name is Leo Besner, and we'll talk about him in a second, couldn't really get a good, clear shot.
Did he actually have a hostage?
No, he didn't. Although he apparently told the hostage negotiator he had somebody else in the house with him, but he was inside the house. But he was actually out in the yard, and Besner could see that he was out in the yard. But apparently the teams weren't talking to each other, and the grand jury said this is a big deal. So eventually Gorder stood up, still talking on the phone, was talking about his dog, was heading back in the house. He did have a gun. I want to make clear he had
a
gun.
He was holding the gun.
And he had shot it off, but nobody knows where the bullet went. So, and Besner just took it upon himself to shoot him in the back and kill him.
Even though
he was being negotiated with.
Because Besner thought that he had heard earlier that the guy said he had a hostage.
No, he thought that he could hurt the people in the neighboring houses who the police had already cleared out. But I guess he didn't get that message either.
The devil was...
Well, let's talk a little bit about Besner.
Yes. Leo Besner has a very bad history. There are two major lawsuits that got settled in the last year that he was party to in the fact that he was the defendant. One was the big, big lawsuit that the National Lawyers Guild folks won a little while back for the protest actions in 2002 and 2003, where Bessner, at a anti-war protest in early 2003, found Bill Ellis, a protester on the street, on the side of the bus mall, told him he was under arrest. Ellis didn't come easily into custody, and he ended up getting tossed into the street, pepper sprayed in the face. And when Bessner wrote up his police report, he said that Ellis had been blocking traffic with his protest sign. When you look at the videos, there was no traffic because the police had already blocked off the street with their transportation vehicle with the CERT team on it, or the rapid response team on it. And B, he was standing on the sidewalk holding it off the edge. So it was complete fabrication, and he got found. It was found insufficient evidence as to whether he falsified his police report. So anyway, so that case ended up with, as part of this overall settlement, of $845,000 that your taxpayer money paid for.
But it was also a good cause.
Right. It helped build the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center, so that's good.
That's right.
The other case was a young woman whose name is Maria Jaquith, I think. She was at a TriMet bus stop. And I think it might have been a smack stop with a friend of hers. She's like 15-year-old Latina, and
this is downtown.
I think it was out on the east side.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. In any case, Bessner and his partner came over to her and her friend and started asking them to follow certain orders, and they ended up throwing them to the ground and roughing them up, and she won $145,000 lawsuit.
And there's no reason for they just walked up and started.
I don't remember the specifics of it. I can probably find the details.
Sounds like he is a problematic employee.
Well, yeah. Well, let me see. He also came upon a 71-year-old man who had gotten under control a woman who was running around with a knife, and because the guy was on top of this woman, or apparently
holding her down. You mean
yeah. Right? Bessner tasered him. The 71-year-old man.
And he was helping.
He was the hero, yeah.
Restrain the person.
Right. So this guy, and he's also been involved in two shooting incidents, and we don't have a lot of details on them. There's one where the guy was a suspect in shooting at a deputy, and he ended up, quote-unquote, committing suicide. So we don't know if Bessner even shot his gun off. It's very unclear from the reports. And there was another incident about within a month of that he was also involved in. So he's somebody who's... You know,
a liability?
Psychological profile should be looked at least, yeah.
Well, yeah. When you have one name coming up that many times and that many incidents, he's holy God.
And that's $1 million that you've had to pay.
Yeah, when you start looking at adding that up. And, you know, frankly, this is sort of, I guess, is still in line with the last caller and the question of if you're not doing anything wrong, what, you know, would you ever have anything to fear? When you have officers like Bessner, clearly. It doesn't matter. I remember reading a lot about the 15-year-old Latina as that happened. And truly, you know, she's a 15-year-old high school student standing at a public transportation stop.
Minding her own business.
Doing anything.
It was a bus stop. So her name was Maria Rodriguez Sanchez. And she and her friend were supposedly acting suspiciously. And so the police asked them for their IDs, and Bessner showed up. So there was actually another officer who started this, Denise Kumper is her name. So when she reached to get a soda from her friend, Bessner and his partner, well, no, not his partner, this guy from Gresham PD, grabbed her arm, shoved her face into a wall, and threw her to the pavement.
Nice.
She was reading a newspaper when the first officer arrived. 15-year-old
girl.
Reading a newspaper.
Well, that's a really subversive activity.
Yep. And they excluded her from TriMet for 30 days, and she won $140,000. So let that be a lesson for you all. Don't read a newspaper at a TriMet stop.
Well, and you know, I just wanted to say before we go to our next caller that apropos of what the last caller said, if you really believe that people who are law-abiding have nothing to fear from the Portland police, I suggest that you talk to some medical marijuana patients in Oregon and other places. You know, in Oregon, if you're a medical marijuana patient and you're following the law, you are completely golden. I personally know at least a half a dozen medical marijuana patients who have been very poorly treated by their local police officers, most of which are in Portland, some of which are not. And it's not always true that the police are nice to you if you're law-abiding. That's just really, It would be a nice thing if that was true.
I would like to believe we will live in a world someday.
Perhaps someday you will.
Okay, so let's go ahead and take a call. Good morning. You are on the air.
Good morning. So I just wanted to say something about the last caller. So in other words,
can you speak up a little bit?
If I don't keep my hands on the steering wheels, it's a capital offense. I deserve to die.
Well, I guess
that was the implication.
That's so illogical. It's pitiful.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wanted to, the drug test, I think I agree 100% with it. I wanted to know if you knew anything more about this poor guy out here in Gresham and Troutdale that caught himself on fire.
Yeah, Fouad Katy. Another tragedy.
And then he was so insane, he was running around literally his skin was hanging off his body.
That's what they say.
And then they tasered him. It's probably didn't have any skin left on his body to keep the tasers in. And then he got up and they shot him. And they shot him 7 times.
Yeah.
He had no weapons, nothing.
Yeah, he was naked.
He was naked.
So, yeah, well, this is one of the things I found interesting.
Another thing is he went to a grand jury and, of course, he was justified.
What's that?
He went to a grand jury and he was justified.
Right, yeah. Well, and it wasn't justified.
What do you have to do in order to say that it's not justified?
Well, let's be clear. The grand juries are asking whether or not the shooting was a violation of law. And so that still doesn't mean these officers are within policy. And the Clackamas County Sheriff is conducting an internal review that has recently been extended for another 2 months and because they need more time. There are a lot of witnesses. So there's still a possibility that they could be found out of policy. I'm not holding my breath on it, but, you know, that's a possibility. And the family also, as I understand, is probably going to file a lawsuit in this case.
Well, good for them.
Cases, I certainly would. They could still, the city of Sandy, the Sandy police officer in Clackamas County could be found, civilly liable. So there's still possibilities that somebody could find that was as outrageous as you and I apparently agree that it was.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. I mean, he was driving home. He went to get some gasoline. All right, he was stupid enough to have gasoline in his car, okay, and he lit a cigarette and the damn thing blew up. And then he was so on fire that when he was running, he started a grass fire, and, you know, you see his car was a shell, and he didn't have any clothes on because he was all burnt up.
Poor man.
And then they shoot him.
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid. You know, these guys are...
That's insane.
And he was...
Godless.
I'm not going to...
Heart and their boys. And I tell you another thing that irritates the hell out of me. I deal with people that have gone through the court system all the time. And the amount of lying police officers do on a daily basis in front of courts is perjury. And if I had to lie as much as they lied, I couldn't sleep at night.
You would think that they would have their consciences to trouble them.
Yeah, I know. It just amazes me the amount of just bold-faced lying that they do in court.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
But, yeah, I don't want it to be lost either that Fouad Katy was Arab-American either.
No, that's important.
You couldn't tell that.
Well,
it's on fire.
That's true. I mean, by the time they encountered him, he probably was unrecognizable.
Yeah, he was unrecognizable. Skin hanging down from his body. I mean, God, kind of animals are these? Anyway.
Well, we don't really know. I think animals tend to treat each other better.
They only
kill when they're hungry.
Thanks very much for your call this morning.
Yes.
And also in this very short time span, there was a killing involving Corvallis police.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know too much about that one, but it just happened in the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm. And it, you know, again, was a person who was apparently, they had a long history of bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
This man was becoming apparently increasingly more agitated and may have had some sort of baton. Can we not train people to de-escalate situations without just shooting someone? This case begs a number of questions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading an article last night that had his mother, this man was 50 years old, his mother 72. She was saying that, you know, he had a long history of bipolar disorder. He really, there was no adequate care. you know, available for him.
What happened to mental health treatment?
You know, and she, you know, she said, you know, she's always been able to sort of de-escalate the situations in the past. You know, why wouldn't the officers call her? She would have liked to have helped, you know, any of this sort of thing. Instead of just, oh, well, you know, here's somebody who's acting out. We're afraid. Again, getting back to that original point,
which
you know,
a great point.
That, you know, responding out of fear and confusion, police officers are killing, and when they kill with impunity. And that is, you know, a horrendous power of the state that I think we really kind of need to, well, curtail.
Right. Well, I think that looking at underlying social problems instead of just giving police more power is a recurring theme lately. And last night, I went to the second of what are going to be three hearings on the drug-free zones, and people there were talking about how the drug-free zones, the business people were talking about how great it was, and how and a woman told a story about how she'd been attacked by a pimp because she'd given a advice to a prostitute about how to get out of the business, and that's a horrible story. I mean, that shouldn't happen. But at the same time, having a drug-free zone wouldn't have solved that problem.
No.
I mean, a prostitution-free zone either. But and so they made these very impassioned pleas that had a very big disconnect from the civil liberties issues. Basically, a drug-free zone is the officers, police officers can go over to somebody who's in one of these zones and say, I suspect you of any list of these drug crimes or prostitution crimes in the prostitution-free zones, and here is your exclusion order. And basically consider this an arrest, but that people never necessarily even go before a judge. They don't even necessarily get prosecuted, but they're excluded from that area for 90 days. If they do get convicted, they're excluded for a year. And the city is deathly afraid of tying this to the criminal charges and saying you only get excluded if a judge reviews it and says, okay, I agree that there's probable cause here. You have to stay out. As a condition of your pretrial release, you have to stay out. They're deadly afraid of that because they want to have a tool that gets around basic civil rights, which is that you have the right to a lawyer and you have the right to due process. It's very similar to the sit live rule, where they're now handing out these yellow cards downtown and say, you have to move along because you can't sit in the sidewalk. They've only given out about three tickets for block obstructions of as nuisance is what it's called. But they've given out probably thousands of these yellow cards just to move people along. So what we're doing is we're just creating this other layer of law where there's no judicial oversight.
That's bad.
It is.
Yeah.
And let me just finish the drug-free zone thing quickly.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So this is very exciting because the drug-free zones were going to get renewed in October, and we kind of raised this issue in our newsletter, the People's Police Report, in
which
September.
Is excellent.
Thank you. We got people got excited about it. Representative Chip Shields from Northeast Portland got involved, the ACLU, the Public Defender's Office, the Western Prison Project, a lot of groups. And I'd say definitely Crossroads last night did a great job turning people out for the downtown hearings. The first hearing was held in North Portland. Two-thirds to three-quarters of the people, when asked, do you think the drug-free zone should be modified or gotten rid of, raised their hands and said, we think that. Last night, same thing downtown. I was really afraid that the Portland Business Alliance and the Downtown Association, Neighborhood Association, were going to turn out lots and lots of suits and ties to defend the zones. And instead, it was the same kind of two-thirds to one-third ratio of people who want to modify or get rid of the zones. Many excellent comments. One more hearing will be held on this before they start writing the new ordinance. And the mayor is behind this. The mayor is saying, I would like to tie this to a conviction so that people don't get excluded unless they're actually convicted of a crime.
Seems reasonable.
The Business Alliance is saying we will have a compromise where an administrative hearings officer will automatically review each case. But basically that's like the executive branch reviewing the executive branch.
Right, right. That doesn't really work.
Not a check or a balance. So we got to make sure that the everybody in the city gets this message. So there's one more hearing. It's going to be out on 82nd Avenue at a school at – in the 100 northeast block of 82nd, and I can't remember the name of the school right now off the top of my head. You can call Peace and Justice Works and Portland Cop Watch at 503-236-3065, and I can get you the information, and I'll get it back to Cable and have it put at the front desk. But this is the last chance to have public input on this, and the more people that turn out, even if you don't want to say anything, this is a forum. It's not like city council where you have to sign up. You just raise your hand and you can talk. But even if you don't want to say anything, the more bodies that are there, and they say, how many people think these are bad, the more clear it'll be that this policy needs to be changed.
All right. Let's go ahead and take a caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. Going back to the most dangerous job in the world, I think one of the most dangerous jobs in the world is working a domestic violence shelter, and also mothers that live in domestic violence situations. I think those are very dangerous jobs in the world, but don't get attention. And also going back to Foxworth, his brother or brothers work for the FBI. I'm curious. I'm surprised that isn't secret information. I was wondering how people got that information. And also, I feel unsafe, even though it's probably an age-old thing, to that people have relatives, people that work in the police or the FBI or CIA have relatives working in these other groups or organizations. But that's my opinion. Goodbye.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much for your call.
FBI agents aren't all undercover. In fact, there's not very many that I know of. But we don't know how many there are. But frankly, Chief Foxworth, when he was profiled when he became chief, that was part of the public information they gave out. I'm sure he's talked about it before that. And, you know, we have a lot of good things to say. Chief Foxworth has done some good things. He's helped bring in some of the changes the park asked him to. He's been open to hearing feedback from Cop Watch, which is definitely can't be said for Chief Croker.
I was going to say, this is, you know, a couple years in now, so how is it to work with this new police chief and now new mayor? You know, it's like, it must feel like a whole kind of...
In many ways it does. There's still, you know, there are institutional structures that are in place and people and individuals that are not going to allow certain things to happen. And as it was, Foxworth didn't want the officers out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, but, you know, it's the Mayor Potter's choice. And people who don't know Mayor Potter...
Good for him.
Mayor Potter was once chief of police, so if I accidentally call him Chief Potter, that's why. So it is very... It's undeniably different from when Mayor Katz was in place and Chief Croker. There's no doubt about it, yeah. And we've seen that in protests. I mean, there's been almost no crackdowns of any kind since Foxworth came in. I wouldn't say that we've been devoid of them, but it's definitely...
I'm
encouraged.
Yeah, I was totally encouraged at the beginning of this month with the World Can't Wait action.
Right, but they still cracked down.
I wouldn't say, they scored 100%. There was not an A+. But, man,
it wasn't Mayday.
There was a big old difference between that and Mayday. Exactly what I'm thinking.
So here's some other good things. I want to end on a bad note, though.
Okay.
Chief Foxworth instituted what's called the Use of Force Review Board. And actually, just the institution of this is problematic in that why we have a police review board, the Citizen Review Committee, which is part of the Independent Police Review Division, that reviews complaints about misconduct when people appeal what Internal Affairs said. Why we have that and then have to set up a separate system to review shootings, I don't understand.
Right.
It's still possible misconduct, and they still should have the same skills to know whether the police violated policy or not. But anyway, they set up a use of force review board that has 7 officers and 2 citizens on it. And the citizens will rotate in and out. There's like a pool of 20 or 30. And the Jahar Perez review that we've been talking about today was held before the use of force review board was really instituted. Nonetheless, Foxworth invited 3 citizen members to sit in on it. They didn't get to vote. Their names are not in the report. It turns out that Chief Foxworth disagrees with the Park Report's recommendation to publish all the votes that were taken in these use of force review cases because the citizens didn't want their names revealed.
Mm.
Now, why, if we fought all these years to get a citizen review board that reviews police shootings, and now we're not going to know the names of the citizens, how can that possibly make us feel better?
That doesn't make sense.
Right. So that's bad, but that's just part one of the bad news. The bad part two, that Chief Foxworth, and this is kind of mixed also, is creating a new layer of bureaucracy within the police bureau called the Office of Professional Standards. So we have Internal Affairs. The way when you file a complaint, you file it to this Independent Police Review Division, part of the auditor's office. If they decide that your case has merit and, you know, could be investigated further, they send it, unfortunately, to the police, to the Internal Affairs Division. And then if you don't like the outcome, then you appeal to the Citizen Review Committee. Now they're creating this bureaucracy above the Internal Affairs unit that has a professional standards side that has the early intervention system in it, which they've said existed for all these years and actually hasn't, and an internal audit unit. And we're not quite sure what the internal audit unit's going to be doing, but the IPR – in the auditor's office. He's supposed to be doing audits of the police. So he's creating this layer of bureaucracy within there, basically to duplicate the function, and I'm afraid to to make it so that there's no point in having the IPR.
Right.
But it's basically police investigating police, and here's my new phrase I'm trying out here for the first time on the show. It's the Foxworth guarding the hen house.
Oh, I like it. I like it. I like it. Well, hey, you know, it's
almost... You have a way with words, Dan.
It's very wonderful. It's almost 8:45, and we just have 15 minutes left in the show until it's time for the radio zine. Our number, 503-231-8187. Let me tell you what's coming up here. At 9, you're going to hear APA Compass featuring an interview with actress, author, and activist, Margaret Cho. Also hear about global issues affecting Asian and Pacific Islander communities. At 10, we'll hear from Per Fogery. He'll interview Captain James Yee, the former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay Prison and author of For God and Country, Patriotism Under Fire. That's going to be excellent. 10:30, Sounds of Awareness. The topic is help for menorrhagia or severe menstrual symptoms. At 11, Democracy Now! Topics include AIDS, a look at the fight against the global pandemic, and student activism in Virginia and New York. Tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News featuring a look at a new Vancouver location for the Community Cycling Center. 5:30, it's Counterspin with a critic of the media from Fairness and Accuracy in Media. And at 6, Bread and Roses, hear an interview with the author of Invisible Woman, Growing Up Black in Germany. So, just, yes, all day long.
All day long. Stay tuned to KBOO.
Here we go.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Is that me?
That's yes. You.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
All right. This is LJ.
Hi, LJ.
Hi. How you guys been?
Good.
Wonderful show, as usual. Very, very topical. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Okay, here's what you're not covering are, like, certain mitigating circumstances. When you're out between midnight and 4 in the morning, it is assumed by the police department that you are not out for any good purpose. And it's policy from the police department that when you're out at that time in a motor vehicle, they have probable cause. Right? I used to be a baker, and I used to work really early in the morning. And I just documented 1 year about how many times I was pulled over. And I was pulled over 26 times.
Oh, my.
In 1 year.
That's once every 2 weeks.
Yeah, for one bogus reason or another. All right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. I finally struck up a sort of a relationship with one of my regulars. I don't want to mention the officer's name on the air, but I was regularly pulled over by this person. And we sort of became a little friendly. Mm. All right. And she told me that if you're driving an older vehicle and if you're out at that time, they have a right to pull you over.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, let's be clear. What you just said is that if you're driving an older vehicle.
Right.
All right. So there's it's economic profiling.
Yes.
So it's kind of like, and the flip side of that is if you're Jahar Perez was pulled over for driving a fancy Mitsubishi in North Portland.
Right.
And the flip side is if you're driving a fancy car in a neighborhood where they think it doesn't fit in.
Right. Okay. Now, I'm working in Lake Oswego, right?
Right.
And I'm driving an L.O. in the speeder.
Right.
And what am I doing in that community?
Right. Oh, L.O. is the Lake Oswego police are very, in my opinion, pretty class-based in who they pull over.
Well, talk to me about it.
Anyway,
I to find that the reason they're pulling you over is to check you for priors.
Uh-huh.
All right? They run you up on the computer, make sure that there's no outstanding warrants on you, okay? And if you're in the clear, they let you go. All right? Boom.
So are you saying that you're okay with this? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
No, of course not.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that's the reality of the situation.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right, exactly. So that's what we have to work to change.
Yeah. That's the mentality. Okay. One more point. Okay.
Okay.
I'm Vietnam era. Okay. Mm-hmm. A lot of the younger police officers are returning veterans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And given the fact that the police department is paramilitary anyway, okay. I had a lot of issues when I came home, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that these guys have the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, when you're in a combat situation and the adrenaline kicks in, reason goes out the window.
Yeah.
Okay? And like, unfortunately, the people who get the 12 to 4 shift or whatever it is, are all young guys who are just coming home from combat.
Yep.
Okay? So, I'll take my answer off the air.
I agree with you.
Thanks.
That's really good
points.
Both Officer Siri and Officer Headcomber were both young, relatively new officers. Officer McAllister that shot Kendra James was a young, relatively new police officer, and there's definitely a pattern there. And that's one of the things that was actually called for by the community, is having, you know, always having an older officer mentor the younger cops. But there's not enough money in the budget for there to be two officers in all the cars, and you know, so what. We have to make some choices as a society about how we want to divvy up these resources in the police.
Definitely.
Maybe if we didn't spend all our money, you know, in places like Iraq, and then we would have enough money for two officers per car.
Right. Or we can say, well, it's okay if there's not officers in two different patrol cars, because we'd rather see two officers together.
Yes. It seems, you know, again, safer if you are
an officer.
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. If you have the adequate training of, you know, disengagement, and you're not, you know, you're actually, the training, again, is not geared to make you as scared as possible in any given situation, then two officers together, it seems like it would allow cooler heads to prevail. There'd be a little reassurance. You know, it seems like a good idea. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got 10 minutes left. I want to squeeze in a couple more.
Okay. Yep. I just want to throw in one more thing, though, about this Office of Professional Standards that Chief Foxworth announced on Wednesday this week.
Uh-huh.
That, as far as my understanding, though I haven't got this confirmed, that the Independent Police Review Division didn't know he was doing this, that it's going to cost $700,000. And to my knowledge, like, we didn't know anything about it. There was no community input. So in what way is this community policing?
And you know, where is that money going to come from?
That's a very good question.
Is it going to come out of the budget for the regular officers' patrols? Or
I don't know. That's what they're complaining about in the newspaper.
Well, I think those are good questions.
If Chief Foxworth can go out and do the money dance and make money rain on him, well, we should. He's in the wrong job.
Right. He should go down to try and
full-time money dancer, you know.
All right. Let's go ahead and squeeze in a couple more callers. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been in Portland 6 months, and I've heard this discussion take place, I think, on this program several times. And it always amazes me how it always seems that the people who hold your point of view, who I consider to be the offended people in the community, always sound so helpless, you know. And when they mention the name of the Portland Business Association and the Downtown Community Coalition or whoever, and it's like they're the almighty, all-powerful rulers of Portland. And it bothers me that there's something about people in general, I guess, that won't allow them to realize and take advantage of their economic influence on what goes on in their community. If there was strategic and selective spending strategy for the downtown businesses and whatever other organizations that put undue and unfair influence on what happens in the community, then the Portland businessmen and whoever else would definitely tell the police what to do. They will do whatever it takes to keep the money flowing into their coffers. So why don't we just do that instead of always talking and whining about how ineffective we are, and oh well, we did get this little bit, and nervously laugh about it.
Well,
get together, decide who it is you're going to boycott, and what the reason is. It doesn't matter whether they're angels or not. So we're doing this to show you how offended we feel. And we expect you to do something about it, and they will do it.
I agree, but the problem is that a lot of the the big ticket vendors downtown who are the movers and shakers in the business association are not people that our audience necessarily supports much anyway, because we don't have that kind of discretionary income to shop at their stores, like, you know, Saks or the fur companies, or, you know, that's not... We're not the most likely.
Imagine if when the people of this country and this city and this state were trying to cause an effect in South Africa, if they had had that attitude. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that, you know, harnessing our economic power is a very important thing.
Yeah. But please don't say but.
What we got to do is also find strategic partners who either are or aren't part of the PBA that work downtown.
Uh-huh.
So last night at the drug free zone hearing, a lawyer named Stephen Berman was there, and he spoke up, and he said the people in the business community only speak for part of it.
Uh-huh.
Got some good applause on that.
It's true.
And he said that what is constitutional and what is right aren't always the same. And it was like this most excellent, he was in a suit and tie, and he was a lawyer who made these excellent points and sort of dissed the PBA and said, you don't speak for all of us down here. And those are the kinds of people we need to reach out mm-hmm. and, you know, and get organized.
Yes, I agree.
I don't disagree with that gentleman that we need to be strategic. I agree with Melody that, you know, we don't have the economic power that might be necessary, but we can probably find people who,
and again,
who have closer ties that have better
I mean,
politics.
I can boycott Nordstrom, but since I never shop there anyway, they're not going to miss my business.
Exactly.
That was sort of what was going on in my head, too. But I do think it's very important to look at how we exercise our resources. How, you know, because when we spend money places, mm-hmm. we are, you know, empowering them.
Yep.
And when we have organizations like the Portland Business Alliance that have been economically calling the shots in the city for a while, you know, then it sort of behooves us to not give them more power than they already have, and to look at, in fact, decentralizing that power. And economic boycotts, I think, are a good idea and part of an overall strategic way to really change the livability of our city.
And that goes back to a few weeks ago, we had Robin Shanti on speaking about the Sustainable Business Network, which is a really, you know, positive organization of businesses in Portland. And perhaps we should encourage some people from that network to get involved in these.
There's
a whole lot
of networking, cross-pollinization we can do.
Because they, of course.
Let's go ahead and squeeze in that last caller because, man, we're running out of time.
Yes, we are.
We've got people on hold. Hi, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Amen to the point that last caller made about the Portland Business Alliance. I've been kind of harping on that myself for a while.
Yeah.
Two quick comments. First of all, when the Jihar Perez case was topical and still under investigation, Joanne had Dan on her show, and I called in to ask about Officer Sari in particular, and Melody already mentioned the idea of steroids. I think in the case of Officer Sari, that was a hugely relevant issue. The guy was obviously a bodybuilder, and
that's why I asked.
You know, the effect of steroids is documented. It makes people aggressive, and I just think that's a no-brainer. That guy should have been tested for steroid abuse, and so that's my first comment. Second comment, relative to the one of the previous callers about military personnel, I want to ask Dan about Cop Watch. If they're have they been talking about the possibility of some of these burnouts from Iraq that we've seen documented on the internet, some of the heinous things that they're doing over there, obvious lack of moral fiber, some of those guys coming back looking for jobs, being hired by local police departments, that's, I think, is a very troubling issue, and I wanted Dan's comment. Thank you.
Right. Well, fortunately, there is a psychological screening that happens for Portland police officers. Unfortunately, we don't know that much about who applies that screening. I mean, his contract is actually up renewal at city council chambers. I think they just passed on Wednesday to renew this guy's contract. But we don't know that much about him or what the screening process is. But there is some kind of screening, and I would hope that you could screen people out who are who need to get some help as opposed to get a gun in their
hand. Yes, one would hope.
Let's go ahead and squeeze in one last caller. Good morning. You are the last caller, and you're on the air.
Well, I've got 3 points. One of the people that I heard was madder than anybody at the
police. Can you speak up a little bit?
Speak up, yes.
When we had a police shooting, I think it was a Mexican in the psychiatric ward.
Yes.
Jose Mejia
Port. There was a a returning Marine who had been in the MPs, and he was absolutely livid that the police had done this because he says, we have training in the Marines mm-hmm. that you do not do this kind of stuff. He was really, mm-hmm. really mad, and this is a returning Marine.
Yes.
Uh-huh. The other thing is, I remember New York story. Person from not too good a neighborhood says, you know, in New York City, the nice cops are showing the little old ladies around on Fifth Avenue, and the other ones are out in our neighborhood. And so what I wonder, is there a rotation of police so that, you know, that, or do some of them get the good duty and others get the bad duty, and they just, or how much rotation?
I see your question.
I think there is rotation. I think officers will ask to get transferred from one precinct to another. There's a lot of promotion that goes on, particularly officers who've been problems seem to get promoted through the ranks pretty easily. Like we have Lieutenant Mark Kruger now, who was an officer that pepper sprayed somebody right in the face and laughed about it in 2003 and wore Nazi uniforms off duty. I think that there, with the, you know, the amount of turnover there is, sometimes you can't hold on to those cops that might be the good cops in your neighborhood long enough. And I think that's unfortunate. I wish that there were a way to enforce that, but if people want to move up in their job and transfer, mm-hmm. you know, it's there's this struggle between labor rights for officers because they are, you know, working cheap all as much as we may hate to admit it, and what the community needs, and I don't know how you strike that balance.
But that's a good question, caller. We're
and one that we'll
time,
have
though.
To address another time.
Yes, indeed.
As
thanks
we,
for calling.
We have about 20 seconds left, so Dan, your
www.portlandcopwatch.org. If you want more information, and our phone number is 503-236-3065.
Thanks once again for coming down, and thanks again for all the hard work you do. Mm-hmm. You are one of the hardest working activists in Portland, I swear. Okay, it's time for us to go away now, and we'll be next back next Friday. And in the meantime, you know what to do. Keep on being positively revolting.
It is 9 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to KBOO-FM, Portland.
Coming up this morning on KBOO.
Kebu at 10 per Fargering interviews Captain James Yee, the former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay Prison and author of Forgotten Country, Patriotism Under Fire. At 10:30 on Sounds of Awareness, the topic is Help for Severe Menstrual Symptoms. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, topics include AIDS, a look at the fight against the global pandemic, and student activism in Virginia and New York. And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News featuring a look at a new Vancouver location for the Community Cycling Center. It's 9:03, and this is KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Ambling Beer Distributor, which distributes and recycles free periodicals. Hi, this is Margaret Cho, and you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Trip to the Philippines. We'll also hear about the continuing situation of unexploded bombs and landmines in Cambodia and the upcoming film premiere, Bomb Hunters. Not to mention another edition of Angry Asian Minute. But first, our interview with Korean American comedian, actress, activist, and author Margaret Cho.
I don't think there was any role models that I had when I was growing up, anybody that I could look to and say, wow, I want to be like that. You know, I never saw anybody. You know, the only thing that's sort of Asian that was like that was Hello Kitty. I don't want to model myself after Hello Kitty, because she has no mouth. She cannot even say hi back to you after you say, Hello, Kitty.
In the years since Margaret Cho first started doing stand-up comedy at age 16, she herself has become a role model for many. And she has done so on her own terms. In an industry with very narrow options and roles for Asian American women, she has managed to defy stereotypes and carve a space with her defiant, raw, and incisive humor. Much of her comedy draws on her personal experiences, detailing her life as a self-proclaimed proud fag hag, her sexuality, her relationship to her mother, and her struggle with racism, substance abuse, and eating disorders. In doing so, her work has given voice and validity to experiences that do not conform to straight white norms. Patty Sakurai, APA Compass Collective member, talks about the impact of Margaret Cho's work.
Having grown up with a complete absence of API women except for in these very demeaning, stereotypical roles, seeing Margaret Cho on stage, seeing an API woman, it was just, there's something just about the image that was just very empowering and exciting. It's hard, I think, if you're a person of color in this country, not to feel isolated in terms of how alienated you might feel by American culture or what happens in the U.S. when when the media and the culture doesn't reflect your experience, doesn't even acknowledge that you exist, and then to have this image and this person up there very clearly carving out a space and asserting some space for herself and some voice.
What is particularly inspiring about Cho is her unapologetic stance, that she is not afraid to speak out, when for many of us, living under a white, heterosexist society, it is safer to keep quiet. Liz Rogers, another collective member, has this to say.
For me, like, you have to be really conscious of who's around you and what things that you say and how you present them. And I think to see someone, an Asian American female, to come out and say a lot of things that I completely agree with, but to be very unapologetic about it and just say, this is how I feel, and you either take it or you don't, for me is kind of like a relief that someone is saying these things and not be apologetic about it and being empowered by it.
Cho's work is not without controversy, however.
I can't remember which of the shows, going into a theater and sitting with a large group of friends and being in the front row, and we're laughing, and, you know, in terms of recognition and really connecting with some of the things she was saying, and there's a certain tension in the back of the room with the other audience members, which was really pretty interesting. And if anything, to me, it validates that she's onto something. I think certain things should be uncomfortable. And there is a difference in terms of where you yourself are situated in your position on how you're going to react to certain things that are said, because there's a way in which her work implicates all of U.S. society. And so depending on where you are in those implications, some things will strike you as more funny than other things. If anything, it was very validating to know that there was some discomfort around some of the things she was saying, because I think bottom line is she was hitting some truths around race, gender, sexuality, so forth in our country, and that's not a necessarily comfortable conversation. And yet I really appreciate comedy as a vehicle, just because there's a way in which you can use humor to launch critique that is incredibly effective.
When Cho's show All American Girl aired in 1994, it was hailed as the first Asian American sitcom on primetime TV. However, it lasted only a season. The network's reluctance to give Cho more creative control resulted in a show that was poorly written and bore little resemblance to the comedy that earned Cho the 1994 American Comedy Award for Best Female Stand-Up. Cho reemerged in 1999 with her wildly successful one-woman off-Broadway show I'm the One I Want, which was later made into a concert film and a book of the same name. Since then, she has performed to sell-out crowds across the country and from shows such as Notorious C.H.O., Revolution, State of Emergency, and Assassin. Her work has become progressively more and more political, tackling issues such as racism, sexism, and homophobia.
I think it's been interesting because, you know, I have had some criticisms of her not addressing so much the Asian American issues, but I think having read her book and then maybe doing the interview gave me a little more perspective as to maybe why it wasn't maybe a safe place for her to do earlier on in her career because of the struggles with her show. And so I think now I'm definitely more appreciative of kind of strategic timing, you know, of speaking out. You know, one thing that I do appreciate is that she's brought in Asian American community into the LGBTQ issues as well, because I think that often is a piece that gets left out quite a bit. We're considered two very distinct communities without the consideration that the communities will overlap.
Recently, on tour promoting her new book titled I Have Chosen to Stay and Fight, Cho dropped by KBOO Studios to speak to APA Compass about her work and her perspectives on Asian America.
Thank you so much for coming in and being on APA Compass. We really just love your work and are really grateful that, you know, you're out there.
Thank you
so
very much.
Just, yeah, really appreciative of the work you've been doing.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
Yeah.
I think most of us have carried the burden of having an assumed representation of all Asian Americans. You being who you are and having such a broad platform and spotlight, and obviously that representation is assumed on you. How does that affect basically what you say and how you say it, knowing that you're automatically representing a whole group of people?
Well, it's really weird. What's strange is, like, I've noticed it now more than ever, and on this book tour especially, like, I go to these different shows to promote my book, and the host is very nice, and he says, well, I love the book, and just tell me, what was it like to make Charlie's Angels? It's like they're trying to be funny, and I get that. It's like, okay, that's funny, and it's fine that you're trying to be friendly. And I just have to be really good-natured about it because I don't want to go, that's really racist, you know, because I want to be friendly to these people because they're not coming at me with this anger or, like, rage or anything like that. It's just really they're just you know, they don't know any better. But I'm sick of people not knowing any better. You know, I'm really sick of that. And because, you know, you would never, ever try to confuse, say, Little Kim and Foxy Brown. You know, God help you if you ever did.
Yeah.
And there is this permission, I think our society has, to trivialize the Asian American experience. And so to confuse me with Lucy Liu, and because it takes so much for an Asian American to get to where we are in entertainment, it really just discredits all the work we have done to get here, you know, by confusing us. And it's, I see how people try to be funny and cute, but it's not funny. But there's this weird permission that people have to make jokes about Asian Americans. Asian Americans somehow retain a kind of foreigner identity, and I'm not sure why. And it doesn't work, that excuse, like, well, we look different. That doesn't work on me anymore, because that's not enough. You know, it's not enough to make it okay.
And maybe just to follow up on that, the assumption that Asian Americans are also passive, quiet, and for Asian American women in particular, the kind of geisha subservient, you know, docile, passive stereotype that for Asian American women in particular, I think sometimes it's hard to fight against all those kinds of expectations. So what inspires you to get up in the morning and say these things that sometimes people are not really interested or ready to hear?
Well, in dealing with that invisibility, what motivates me is speaking with other people who also recognize that invisibility in their lives. And this extends past Asian American and also ethnic minority experience. It goes into the gay and lesbian community, and it goes even further. Like, it's a very strange thing. Invisibility is so hard to explain also to people who are not invisible and have never had that experience and don't know what you would be talking about at all. And they say, well, why are you so upset? Jackie Chan is a really big star. And it's good that I chose the field that I'm in, which is stand-up comedy, because it's a place where anger is really allowed, that anger and this aggressive voice is actually welcomed, and it's a better format for that. And it's a good place for me to be as an artist because it suits my temperament and my situation. But it can be really trying. So I guess what keeps me going is just that communication with other people who experience the same thing, and also the amazement that I feel whenever I do bring this up with, say, a straight white male person who may be speaking with me, and they have the most amazing answers that I can't believe. Like, I was talking to this guy about it, you know, on a radio show, and then he just said, well, don't you think Asians just don't want to be in entertainment? And he felt completely comfortable saying that, and nobody around has ever even blinked like that was a racist statement, or even if it was insensitive at all. He just was making an observation, as a straight white man would. I just don't think Asians want to do this, because I don't see any. And they look at the world in a very different way than we do. I mean, I talk about in my book why I would really love to be a straight white man just for a weekend, because I think it would be so relaxing. Because they think so simply about things. They don't have to really have all of that cultural baggage and the racial baggage that we do. So it's very odd where you realize that, oh my God, the world that I live in is so ignorant. And they don't even care that they're ignorant. They don't even want it to be pointed out. They don't care to learn it because they just never, ever thought anything they did was wrong. I think sometimes I get very tired of it. I mean, I get so sick of trying to teach white people about racism. I think, why is this my job? If our schools did a better job, if we had more of an understanding of other cultures, if we didn't deny so much of our own racist history, then I think things would be better. And why am I left to do this job that should have been done by our teachers in our schools?
What led you to do stand-up comedy?
It was something that made sense to me because I knew that I could do it. I knew that I had that ability within me to be a good performer and do stand-up comedy. I don't know how I knew, but I knew. Because I didn't have the kind of personality for it, but I was a very shy kid. Yet I really didn't want the life that my parents really had planned for me, and that would be go to an Ivy League school and pursue a career that was completely empty, which is what a lot of my peers are going through now. You know, they're in their mid-30s, and they listen to their parents all this time, and now they're just lost because they don't want to be the lawyer, doctor, whatever. They don't want all the things that their parents kind of forced them to do, and so that now they're in this midlife crisis and very unhappy, whereas I'm very, very satisfied with everything. So I'm glad that I made that choice. I was independent enough as a teenager to do that. In the end, you know, my parents are very happy for me now. They're really grateful for my headstrong personality and my way, but, you know, it was probably pretty difficult when I was going through it, like when they were really angry at me, you know, for doing comedy and talking about them.
How would you describe your relationship with the Asian American community?
Well, my relationship with the Asian American community is interesting. It's changed. When I first came about doing my sitcom All American Girl, I think that my appearance was very shocking to people because here the network was trying to appeal to the Asian American community and say, here's this young girl that's doing this and she's like one of you. And yet I think that I was really rejected a lot by older Asian Americans because the sudden appearance of this, like, okay, here's somebody that's supposed to be representing you was just so unwarranted and uninvited and kind of, you know, very shocking. And so people got caught up in very specific things. Like when I did television, there was a big thing on emphasis on, well, these are not Korean actors portraying Koreans. And I don't think that's that important, but some people think that's very, very important because they have a lot of incredible tension between, say, Koreans and Japanese, mm-hmm. Japanese and Chinese, all this very historical rage against each other that brought about by all the different wars and these different rivalries and everything. And so, but I think more along the lines of Asian Americans are all, we're all here, and so we have to find unity here in order to be one minority here instead of a bunch of different little ones. And so I never found that particularly that important. And, you know, you look at white actors who are able to cross ethnic lines, national lines all the time. And nobody even mentions it. Nobody cares. But we're held up to a different standard because of our invisibility. I think that was the main complaint about the television show that I did, is that the actors were portraying Koreans and they were not Korean. I think what the problem was doing television was that because the network was so concerned about the fact that this was an Asian American family and they thought that the Asian faces on a show would be so shocking to middle America that they had to make the writing, the content of the show as mediocre as possible. So the show didn't work because we weren't allowed to be ourselves at all, and we were so focused on this idea of ethnicity and defining that ethnicity that it was a failure, because you can't really define ethnicity and have that be the only trait of somebody's personality. But I think that's what has happened a lot to Asian actors in the mainstream. You know, if you watch a television show and there's an Asian actor featured in it, most likely their ethnicity has so much to do with their storyline and their what they're doing and their role in the show that they just become just a race, not a character with feelings that have, they have interaction. I mean, like, okay, I like the show Lost a lot. And I like the Korean people on that show because I think they're very real. Mm-hmm. I think they're very, very authentic. However, their purpose on that show is really just to be Korean. Most of the characters that you see on anything, in any film or television show, their ethnicity has so much to do with them that why don't you just have like a map of the country or something? Because it's a very... I think insulting way to deal with trying to make the television world or the film world look like the world as it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, but getting back to my relationship with the Korean community, it was very difficult for me in the beginning because I had to kind of negotiate through all of these feelings people had. And nowadays, my relationship is actually very, very interesting. I mean, it's great because a lot of kids grew up with me and watched me on television and were very excited because I was like talking and relating an experience that they had, that they understood. Like when I talked about my mom, they had the same mom. You know, they had the same kind of incredible, like, embarrassment at having this very foreign mother and having to deal with that. And, you know, talking about that was very cathartic for them, too. So we have the whole generation that's grown up with my work, and so I have a great amount of respect there, too. And I think that the older generation is also catching up with that and sort of realizing that, you know, my impact on the community has been pretty big. And so it's great now. You know, I've reached this sort of elder statesman status, but it's a cool thing. It was very hard in the beginning, and I think it was harder because I'm a woman. They didn't see a man up there going first. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they didn't have, like, some pro golfer or whatever, I'm sure, which they would really love. But it was just me. So, you know, I was not the best representation of their culture. So that was then. But now things are much improved.
And maybe just to extend your point about how in the media or even in general, there's the expectation that if you're a person of color, all your experiences get filtered through, say, your race. Mm-hmm. And that's the main storyline. That's how you interact with people. And that's the only way you live. Mm-hmm. And your work deals with sexuality, queer issues, and identity is a really large part of your work. How do you see
see these issues intersecting, and also how does that inform your work?
Well, I do a lot of work with the gay community and work on marriage equality, and one of the big questions that people always ask, they always say, well, you're married. And I say, well, yeah, I'm married, and I've been married for 3 years, and I'm very happy in my marriage, and I'm married to a man, and it's a very conventional marriage, just it's very kind of traditional and tidy, and it is what it is. And people say, well, why are you such an advocate of gay marriage? Why are you so concerned about gay rights if you're not actually, like, gay? And today, nobody would question the white students who went to Mississippi to march with Martin Luther King. Nobody would question their motives. Nobody would say anything that think that was an odd thing at all. But people do treat me like that's really the strangest thing in the world. And so I think that really says something, that we have this great divide in terms of what really constitutes minority status. And mm-hmm. my feeling is that minority status really is something that can be reversed with that unity, but that unity is very hard to create, especially with the kind of animosity that exists between certain ethnic cultures and, like, the gay community, and then certain ethnic cultures within themselves and amongst themselves, like, you know, as we said a little earlier, from between, like, Asian communities that are divided by their nationality, that there are those problems, but the deeper problems that exist, there's the African-American Korean conflict that seems to be this constant in many cities, and then there's the African-American community versus the gay community, which is also a big problem too. There's a lot of friction there. So it's my understanding that if we found a way to actually communicate with each other and really let go of some of the tension and the friction between us, we would actually be a much more powerful political force. But the way to that, I don't know. I mean, it's so incredibly difficult to do that, to somehow reconcile these different communities. And, you know, I myself don't have a grand vision of how that will happen or when that will happen. But, you know, I try to do what I can through my work, which I think is the best that I can do, and just informing people and utilizing humor to do so. So I'm sort of disarming them while trying to show them this is a better way. But, you know, it's a really difficult thing. You know, people really don't want to let go of their own prejudices, even though they have so much prejudice against them. And that's very frustrating, because when you're seeing so much ignorance, then we could get over that. We could actually somehow rise above that if we were more connected to each other. But it's very frustrating.
You're listening to an interview with Margaret Cho here on APA Compass.
You know what, Margaret? I think the Asian thing puts people off.
What the hell's the Asian thing? Like, it's some gimmick that I pull out of my ass every couple of years to jazz up my career. It's like, oh, oh, hey, ah. Do the Asian thing, all right, hey, is that ice tie? Yeah, all right. You know you gotta chink it up sometimes, you know. You gotta get chinky with that.
What's your response to criticism around your material not addressing Asian American issues enough?
Well, I feel like whenever I'm doing something as a performer, I'm invested in what it is. And so I don't really go for things like, okay, is this going to serve my Asian Americanness more? You know, it's just what I happen to be interested in. You know, right now I'm very interested in Asian American issues because I'm seeing this very frustrating rise in casual racism, which casual racism is that kind of comment like, oh, you're great in Charlie's Angels, or, you know, that kind of casual racism that is so just trips lightly off the tongue that nobody thinks about. That is so frustrating to me that I wanted to just get into it and really talk about it. And so this is a very Asian American issue that I want to deal with now. And, you know, when it comes to criticism of any kind, I'm pretty thick-skinned about most of it because I've had so much of it in my career that it all seems meaningless because so much criticism criticizes different things. So how could I listen to one and not listen to the other? Or, you know, so I have to discount all of it because none of it really is valid because there's somebody else with just as valid a point that is tearing down another critic. So it doesn't really make sense to me to get, you know, upset about it or change the course of my work because of it. But, you know, Asian American issues, like, are so interesting to me now just because of this rise of very racist attitudes that nobody thinks are so bad.
Mm-hmm. Your point about casual racism, I think, hits the nail on the head, because how we think about racism is sort of defined in terms of either violence or in terms of outright discrimination, that sort of assumptions about other people, et cetera, the things that sort of roll off the tongue.
Yeah, making our experience is somewhat diminished or trivialized. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what's really infuriating, too. Like, again, like going back to this book tour, and there's a line in the book that says, I'm just so sick of hearing from these ancient white guys. And I went on the show, and this talk show host was really angry, not angry, but he was like, he said, well, I have a lot more to say. And I said, well, that's fine. You can say it, but can't you allow other people a voice? Why do you have to fill up all of the airways? And he was just really offended by that, because he couldn't imagine why I would want to shut up the ancient white guys, why I would want... And through doing that, he's really trivializing my experience and trivializing my frustration at this. And when I go on to these shows and I talk about racism and everything, they just are very like, okay, you're all right, little lady, don't get all upset about it. It's all right, you know. And it's a very weird thing. And then they just want to talk about what Asian girls are really hot. That's what they think they want. They're talking about race. Like, some of these people, they think they're talking about race when they say filing is really hot. And I'm like, that is true, but it has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. And they're like, well, you wanted to talk about race, right? Well, I love Japanese girls. They're the most sexy. So I think that trivialization is like the most frustrating thing, and what I always want to kind of get into.
Yeah. And actually, that reminds me of this idea of racist love, that these are not negative descriptions of Asian Americans. They're positive. I mean, Asian American women, they're sexy. That's a compliment.
I know.
And, yeah. And I don't see that how that could be incredibly damaging.
Yeah. And then it can diminish our role in society. So that's all we provide, is that we are this sexual fetish. I mean, okay, that's fine, but then if we had a complete image, if we had a complete identity within that, that would be totally okay. But there's nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's very demeaning. Then if we don't identify as sexy women, then are we without any value at all to the society? It's almost like that's what it's saying. Like, we shouldn't even bother to exist. And there's a lot of controversy right now over the Harajuku girls.
Oh, yes.
People are very upset about them, and then people really like them, too. And I can't really decide, because I am so thrilled whenever I see Asian people that I'm like, oh, I don't care. I love them. You know, I'm trying to, like, see Asian people as much as I can in the media. I don't want them to go away. I don't want them to be vanished because people are angry. I want them to exist because they are there, you know, and they represent us. No matter how distorted and wrong it is, it's still some kind of existence. And that is a joyful one for me. And, you know, it's exciting. I think one of them is actually American. And she's great, you know, because she's just going along with it. So I don't want to argue it down, because I don't want them to go away. But they make Asian people really mad. You know, they people get really upset about them. And I understand that completely. But they remind me a little bit of myself, because people used to get really mad at me the same way. So it's a kind of like return to that a little bit. You know, it's a complicated thing. You know, when that's all there is, it's a sad state of affairs. And it's sad to me, too, that whenever, you know, we're so incredibly starved for any kind of representation, that whenever one comes along, we're just ready to rip it apart. You know, we're ready to just and fight amongst ourselves about it. And that's really sad. You know, it's really sad that we don't have more representation.
It's your show, All American Girl 1994. Do you think anything has gotten better, or anything has changed as far as Asian Pacific Americans in the media?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, well, yeah, there's these people on Lost. There's Sandra Oh, who I like very much, and there's Bobby Lee, who I also really love, and John Cho, who's amazing, and there's a few people, but that's really it. You know, you have so few, and it's just astounding. You know, it's been
over 10 years since we did the television show, and there's just still nothing. So I've actually gone back, and I'm going to develop a television show now to do again, because I realized that it's not going to happen again unless I do it again. So I want to create another television show, and I'll actually be playing a different role this time. I'll be playing my mother on the show, which I'm really excited about because I think is really great, and I think it'll be really fun. And, you know, I'm much more confident going back into television because I'll be producing and writing on the show. So it's got a lot more of a chance of surviving because I'll be driving the whole thing. And, you know, I have a lot of support at the network and a lot of confidence about it now, which I didn't have when I was going into this initially. And also a lot more knowledge about how race really affects the minds of people who are, I just need to like tone that down, you know, that they have to like focus so much on the racial identity. But so since I have more of a handle on it, I feel like it's going to be really, really much easier.
Well, when is that going to come out?
That'll be next fall.
I have another question. You've done a lot of interviews. Is there something that you wish people would ask you that you feel like people have not?
I don't know what I wish people would ask me. I know that I have things that I wish people wouldn't ask me. Like I, you know, wouldn't ask me about where I'm from. No, where are you really from? That is like the question that makes me so angry. You know, I've been really doing so much of this kind of stuff that people ask me pretty much anything. And they're pretty insensitive about things sometimes, but it's all right. It's not too bad. I'm used to it.
So you're still getting asked where you're from?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, not every day, but a lot. You know, where are you from? No, where are you really from? It happens, and then nobody even bats an eye. I mean, people are just very curious, and I think it's the responsibility of our media to show that we're actually not foreign. We have a very irresponsible media, which really neglects this amazing cultural landscape that is America. We have this, you know, very, very narrow-minded, very monochromatic media that doesn't really see anything except white people. And so when we change that, it will get better. Those questions will kind of go away, those questions that really frustrate Asian Americans.
And when do you think that will be?
I don't know. I hope sooner than later.
Yeah. Also, talking about the media, I mean, what is your perspective on Asian American filmmakers? There's starting to be some publicity around certain Asian American films. What do you think about the direction that it's going? And also, are you planning on doing anything like that down the road as well?
I'd love to. I mean, I'd love to do more films, and that's certainly something that's in my future. But, you know, my favorite film, like, of the last couple of years is probably Better Luck Tomorrow, mm-hmm. because it's such a beautiful film, and the acting is so great, and all those boys are just so beautiful, and just it's just a beautiful feeling to be able to like see this kind of play out. It's like, wow, this is actually like our identity, and it's right there, and it's very real to me. It's very authentic and really magical. I really love John Cho. I think he's really great, really like handsome, really elegant comedian, and also great dramatic actor too. That kind of cuts through a lot of stereotypes and a lot of ignorance just by his presence. And so I really hope that he makes a lot more movies. The whole like state of Asian American film is really great because here's this very, very frustrated community trying to tell their stories and learning how to. And that's all very exciting. So I think that there's going to be some really great things coming out.
I was talking to a friend, and we talked about how she wrote you a letter, and I guess the letter was about while she was in Indiana, she said that you were coming to visit, and her comment was that the Asian Americans in Indiana really needed someone like you. Does that make you feel some kind of sense of obligation or put some kind of pressure on you? Or
I guess that it might, but I've been under that pressure for a long time, so I'm used to it, and I would love to share that with other people. I wish that there were more Asian American voices out there. I mean, if not just politically, but, you know, maybe in my field in stand-up comedy, it would be great. But it's something that I have been waiting on for a long time. You know, I haven't seen it happen, but I really encourage it when it hopefully it will.
Do you ever feel like, because you have been doing this for such a long time and you're one of the few people, that has it just been really isolating?
Yeah, it's isolating. I mean, it's certainly lonely because I can't really, like, I can't say to my comedian friends, oh, this is so dumb. I can't, you know, can't really, because I can't really explain the idea of invisibility to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because white male straight comedians in this business don't really know why I would be upset about racial things. They don't really know. Like, they kind of go, well, you're not black, so, you know, you don't experience racism, really.
Yeah.
They don't, I mean, it's like the most ignorant population, so I can't really speak to my peers about what all this feels like. And it is very isolating. It's very lonely. But that's okay, you know, also, because I get to talk to people that really understand, like you guys really understand what I mean, you know, and my audiences really understand what I mean. So in that, it's much less lonely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had a really nice line about sort of how do you talk about invisibility because it's so intangible. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I think that you're hitting on, or I think a lot of people, is that how do you talk about it if there's also sometimes no vocabulary? Mm-hmm. That if we don't have a kind of discussion and talk about these things, then how do other people have a voice and have a vocabulary or a forum to talk about those kinds of things?
Right. And to talk about it without allowing the dominant culture to trivialize it, mm-hmm. because you can't define it, really. It's hard to define or explain to them. I mean, you can define it amongst yourself, but it's hard to explain to them, so then they can easily trivialize it, and then it becomes so doubly frustrating. So it's a very, very difficult time to be a minority in this situation right now at this time, because it's so hard to define and hard to deal with that kind of invisibility.
I think a lot of us are really appreciative of the work that you're doing, because there hasn't been enough of a voice out there for Asian Americans, and also just what you're doing and the kind of courage it takes.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, it's why I do it. It's an incredible reward to whenever I feel that recognition. It's a great, great feeling. Then I realize that I'm not doing it for nothing, you know, that it actually is, like, I really am addressing something that's real, and it really has a great impact. So it's very powerful. So thank you.
Introducing Miss Margaret Cho. She's the Asian ballet girl who's got much to show. She kind of looks like Connie Chung, but in her own slutty way. It's Margaret Cho. It's Margaret Cho. It's Margaret Cho. It's
As part of its military campaign in Southeast Asia, the U.S. carried out a heavy bombing campaign in Cambodia, dropping approximately 540,000 tons of ordnance between 1968 and 1973, killing countless civilians. Significant amounts of this ordnance did not explode on impact. Referred to as UXO, unexploded ordnance, along with landmines left from years of occupation, civil war, and the Khmer Rouge, have continued to kill and injure Cambodians. More widely scattered than landmines, UXO account for about half of the explosions that have occurred in Cambodia in recent years, and the Red Cross estimates that as many as 6 million landmines and pieces of UXO are still in Cambodia today. While 82% of landmine casualties occur from accidental contact, 63% of UXO casualties occur as a result of intentional tampering, as many Cambodians are forced by economic need to look to UXO for scrap metal to sell. According to the 2004 Landmine Monitor Report, over 5,000 new mine and UXO casualties were reported between 1999 and August 2004 in Cambodia. Keelong Ung, president of the Cambodian American Community of Oregon, describes the situation in Cambodia today.
There's so many
things that happen in Cambodia in terms of current situation. You're talking about the landmine, there's a whole story to it, and you talk about the economic situation, there's another story to it, and you talk about democracy, corruption, you're talking about poverty, it's all kind of stuff that's left over from, I always think of this as a legacy of Vietnam War. People that are still blowing up today. People will go look for bombs. And all these problems are all related. Poverty is still all over the country. And because of that, people will go after these landmines and unexploded bomb shells for scrap metals. I often thought of Vietnam War as kind of like a virus. And Cambodia happened to be infected by that virus, and we were still paying the price today.
With 43% of the rural population in Cambodia living below the poverty line, the need to find sources of income often exceeds concerns for personal safety. As Patty Duncan, assistant professor in women's studies at Portland State University, explains,
rural villagers harvest scrap metal for profit, and they do this to survive. They do it to protect their families. They do it to make enough money to feed their families, and they do it at great personal risk to themselves. This actually brings very, very little income to them, but it's often one of the few ways that they can survive financially.
Keelong Ung points to the need to address the role of poverty in the UXO and mine situation in Cambodia.
One important point that I think people should understand about the victims of the landmine is that even today in Cambodia, there are no comprehensive social programs to help transition the victims out of poverty. The worsening long-term effect is yet to come. I truly believe that, you know, the future generations of these victims will remain in poverty.
For Cambodian Americans in the U.S., the situation still hits home.
People who live here think of it this way, you know. Before the Khmer Rouge, there was over 7 million Cambodians, and then after the Khmer Rouge, there were only maybe half of that number, 3.5 million perhaps, survived. And out of that, it's only a handful of us that actually got out and, you know, rebuild new life. And so we always felt that we left those who were less fortunate, you know, our brothers and sisters back in Cambodia. And no matter how well we do in this country, we always thought back to those who were left behind, and always find some way to help out. You know? And anything at all that happened in Cambodia brings out a lot of old feelings, a lot of nightmare. You know, all those horrible past come back any time when there's something happened. You know, any news about an unnecessary fatal explosion in Cambodia or something like that, it digs up the old feelings.
Patty Duncan also served as the associate producer for Bomb Hunters, a documentary film about the UXO situation in Cambodia, produced by local filmmaker Sky Fitzgerald.
We wanted to document the long-term consequences of war in Cambodia that persist in the form of landmines and unexploded ordnance that literally cover Cambodia. We also wanted to help viewers to understand the effects of war on civilian populations long after a conflict has ended. In Cambodia, for example, what we know is that it'll take over 100 years to clear the land of unexploded ordnance and landmines. I hope that people can come to understand that what happened in Cambodia is continuing to happen now in the world.
Keelong Ong also explains his own hopes for the film.
Many people are going to come out of this film thinking a different way, have different perspective, different thought. Some may look for blame. Some may look for justification for certain things. But for me, I'm hoping that this film would basically just heighten the awareness that we have a problem in Cambodia and it needs to be solved. I don't really care about the past and who did what, who's done what. My biggest wish right now is that problem in Cambodia gets solved. Everybody helping out. I'm looking for productivity. I'm not looking for blame.
In terms of this future productivity, he also looks to the second generation of Cambodian Americans.
I think by helping the children here to understand where their parents come from and what's the history behind it and how they get here, and also get them to understand that there's some problems in Cambodia that still need to be done. By teaching children to understand their culture, not just the benefit this country, but also they will grow up to help people in Cambodia who are left behind.
Bomb Hunters will screen at the Hollywood Theater on International Human Rights Day, December 10th, as part of Cambodian Heritage Month. Doors will open at 6:30, and the screening will be preceded by live Cambodian music and Apsara dance. For more information on the film, you can go to www.bombhunters.com. For more information about the Cambodian American Community of Oregon and other Cambodian Heritage Month events, you can go to www.cacoregon.org.
For the ordinary American, the new democracy in other countries is the death of real democracy at home. History is giving you the chance. Seize the time.
Last summer in the Philippines, 85 international delegates from around the world joined Philippine national organizations on a human rights violations fact-finding mission. Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo was originally a people power president who now rules by force, suppression, and deception. In another sad irony, the Philippines has been declared by the U.S. as the second front in its war on terror. Arroyo has been recognized by the U.S. for her unflinching support to U.S. wars of aggression, and she was recently named as head of the anti-terror task force in Asia. In response, an international solidarity mission has formed. Known as the ISM, the goals of this mission is to bring to the world's attention the extent of human rights violations and state terrorism occurring in the Philippines under the U.S.-supported Philippine government. This is Afifa Ahmed Shafi reporting for APA Compass. I'm in the studio with another APA Collective member, Claire Oliveros, who is a Portland resident and attended the ISM delegation this past August. Hi, Claire. Can you tell us about yourself and why you joined the ISM delegation to the Philippines?
Hi, I'm Claire Oliveros, and I'm a second-generation Filipino-American born and raised here in Portland. This trip was very much a personal journey for me to examine my own class privilege living here in the U.S. and see for myself firsthand the class struggle of some of my own family members as well as the conditions of people living in the Philippines.
Can you tell us how the ISM conducted its work and what was the response of locals?
The ISM was divided into five teams to focus on areas of the Philippines where the most heinous human rights violations have been perpetrated in the past couple of years. I was able to join the Hacienda Luisita team and traveled to Hacienda Luisita, Tarlac City, which is about 3 hours north of Manila. And my team consisted of 28 international delegates from 11 countries. The HL team also visited the area to see conditions in the community, to view the deployment of military, and observe collective farming initiatives. The evidence we collected included 34 in-depth interviews with victims, their families. We also gathered autopsy reports, photographs of the injured, and we also watched raw video footage of incidents, and we participated in visits and observations of the sites of where the incidents occurred, especially the massacre site. We were warmly welcomed by the strikers and their families, the church leaders, and members of the community and certain local officials. We had the opportunity to live among the sugarcane workers and their families on the picket line, sleeping in open bunkers and having our meals outdoors with them. The team endured harsh conditions, and some of the team members even became sick during the visit, including myself, because of the stress of the mission and the outdoor living conditions.
Wow, that sounds like intense work. Did the ISM have any negative experiences from those who were in opposition to what type of work you were doing?
Yes, our team experienced some harassment while staying in Hacienda Luisita, which included a flyer denouncing the ISM, and truckloads of military would drive slowly by the picket line, staring us down and intimidating some of the ISM participants, or stopping and blocking our path, or blasting their music really loudly to interrupt our meetings. All the delegates were forced to sleep at the picket line because of the military deployment in almost all of the barangays and townships.
Claire, can you tell us what types of human rights violations did your delegation witness?
The types of human rights violations encountered included 3 targeted assassinations of activists, massacre of civilians at the picket line, some experienced torture within the factory compound after the shootings. There were also illegal detentions. Other human rights violations consisted of death threats and intimidation, forced confessions, and sexual molestation of female detainees, and denying land and labor rights to agricultural and factory workers.
Claire, can you share with us a specific story of a human rights violation that was recorded by your delegation?
One of the most heinous examples is the story of Mr. Javi Basilio, who was 21 and shot in the leg during the massacre. He tried to crawl to safety. Friends tried to help him but were subject to targeted shooting, so had to leave him there. The police or military then reached him and tried to drag him back into the compound. Mr. Basilio resisted and begged for his life. The police responded by hitting him in the face with their rifle butts, breaking his cheekbones and kicking him. He continued to resist, so they tied barbed wire around his neck, dragged him inside the compound, and hung him on the fence before shooting him in the chest. His body was found dumped outside the gates at 3 a.m. on November 17, 2004.
What was the conclusion of the ISM findings at the end of your delegation?
The ISM ended with the International People's Tribunal on August 19th. Really, this was the centerpiece of the findings of the whole entire mission. And the International People's Tribunal concluded with a guilty verdict for the U.S. President George W. Bush and Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo for crimes against humanity.
Claire, how do you plan on continuing your work here in the U.S.?
Here in Portland, we've formed an organizing committee called the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines. As an organizing committee of Filipinos and allies, we aim to work in solidarity to generate support for Filipino people in the struggle for national liberation. We're having our first general interest meeting on Friday, December 9th from 6 to 8 at PSU in the Smith Memorial Student Union Building, room 333. If you're interested in getting involved or for more information, please contact us by email at pdxchrp@yahoo.com. I hope others will join PCHRP in this international movement to shine a light on the human rights violations in the Philippines and continue the momentum that was started.
This month, on December 3rd from noon to 5, take part in a community forum with Mayor Tom Potter and some of the local immigrant and refugee organizations looking at how new immigrants can be integrated into the Portland community with equal access to processes and services. Language interpretation will be available. For information, call 503-223-4464. On December 7th, from 7 to 10 p.m., hear from 3 Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange at PSU's Multicultural Center and the Smith Memorial Student Union. The tour will address medical, environmental, and legal issues associated with chemical warfare. This event is sponsored by Veterans for Peace Chapter 72, Education Without Borders, KBOO, PSU Multicultural Center, and Students for Unity. For more information, contact Dan Shea at 503-661-1317. The Cambodian American Community of Oregon is proud to announce the Khmer Heritage Celebration to be held on December 31st,
marking the final day of Cambodian Heritage Month. This event will include Cambodian classical dances, buffet-style dinner, and live Cambodian music. The celebration will be held at the Doubletree Inn Lloyd Center. Doors open at 5 p.m. For more information and ticket prices, contact Jim Nit Han at 503-621-2755. Details can also be found at www.cacoregon.org.
And now, Pam Fawn with the Angry Asian Minute. I'm curious about our national obsession with our collective psyche. News stations spew countless poll results in the hopes of swaying us one way or another. Everyone wants to know what the average ordinary American thinks. Even as a child, I often ask myself what would make me more American, despite the fact that I was born in America. Because, of course, the ordinary American is entitled to individual thoughts and feelings to the letter of the law, rights protected under our fair Constitution. But, by definition, the ordinary is the mundane, the average, the inferior in quality, or the lack of exceptional ability. In short, the ordinary is boring. Is this who we want to be? Millions of second-rate cogs greasing the wheels of what we all recognize as extraordinary times? In discussing the invisibility of Asian and Pacific Americans on this program, we often have the immediate reaction that we ought to be included and considered equally in our American society. But I'd like to pause here for a moment. If equality means lumping me and many of my exceptional brothers and sisters into a system that rewards mediocrity and sloth, well, thanks but no thanks.
We'd like to thank Margaret Cho, Patty Duncan, and Keelong Ong for their time and contributions. Today's program was executive produced by Patty Sakurai, Marie Lowe, and Liz Rogers, and also engineered by Marie Lowe. Questions and comments can be emailed to apacompass@gmail.com. For more information on APA Compass and our collective, please go to www.apacompass.org. Thanks again for listening to APA Compass, KBOO's Asian Pacific American Public Affairs program. Please remember to tune in the first Friday of every month from 9 to 10 a.m. for your Asian Pacific American orientation.
This is KBOO Portland. My name is Per Fagrang, KBOO News and Public Affairs. And our guest is Captain James Yi, who was a Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo, who got into a lot of trouble with the military. And he will be speaking here in Portland on December 13th at the First Unitarian Church, which is at the corner of Southwest Main and 13th. And he's also the author of a new book, For God and Country. James Yi, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks for having me today.
Well, you went to West Point. How do you go from West Point? Most West Point grads don't become chaplains, do they?
Actually, you're directly commissioned after West Point into usually one of the combat arms branches, like infantry, armor, field artillery, air defense, and that aspect. But a chaplain is a direct commission. It's a professional, one of the professional corps of the military, and you have to get additional graduate training to become a chaplain, similar like a doctor or attorney.
Right, okay. And then you, when were you assigned to Guantanamo?
I arrived down to Guantanamo in November of 2002.
2002. How long were you there?
And I served down there for 10 months.
Uh-huh. Okay, and, well, let's see. What was it like and what were your duties?
Yeah, Guantanamo Bay. I was the Muslim chaplain assigned to Camp Delta, the controversial prison camp where at that time some 660 prisoners, all of the Muslim faith, were being caged. Today, some 500 still remain, most of them indefinitely without charge. I was the Muslim chaplain assigned to that operation, and my role was to advise the command on this unique religious paradigm where you have all the prisoners who are Muslim. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was also to provide observation and recommendations to the command regarding prisoner treatments, both individually and collectively. So those were my two main roles as the chaplain down there at Guantanamo.
And now Camp Delta, is that the most severe of these sections? I've heard there are different sections of the Guantanamo bays.
Camp Delta is considered the maximum security prison down there. There are other sections which have been built while I was down there and also subsequent to me being down there. But Camp Delta is where the general population is being held. Each in their own individual cell.
Really? This is where most of the prisoners are housed?
That's where most of them were housed. Almost 90% of the prisoners were being housed in Camp Delta. That was when I was there 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. Did you counsel the prisoners at all or meet with them, or how did that go?
Well, I did have authorized unescorted access into the prison camp, so I met with the prisoners and spoke with them on a personal level. I was one of the very few who was allowed to interact with them and hold conversations with them. But that was all within my role as a chaplain, to listen to their complaints, listen to their concerns.
Mm-hmm.
A good chaplain is a good listener.
Sure.
And I would hear from them how they were abused and mistreated in the cell blocks when I wasn't around or when other officers weren't around, as well as what they were subjected to sometimes in the interrogations.
Mm-hmm.
I relayed this information to the command so that these problems can be addressed. I mean, these were issues that needed to be addressed by the command because they often led to prison disturbances, prison riots, even more drastic measures sometimes as hunger strikes and suicide attempts in protest of how the prisoners were being treated and in protest of how the Quran and the religion of Islam was being treated.
How did the commanders react to that? Did they respond to it positively in any way at all?
They actually called upon me to try and solve and resolve many of these problems. Of course, those things that happened in interrogation, I had no control over. I was assigned to the detention side of the operation. But what was going on in interrogation, I had no influence. I was far removed from that part of the operation.
Mm-hmm.
But those things that were happening in the cell blocks, in the holding areas, which was handled by the military police, some of those things I was able to get changed. And I'll give you an example. When I first initially got down there, female guards were allowed to do pat-down searches of these male prisoners. And these pat-down searches often included invasive areas, the private areas, the buttocks. They had this procedure called the credit card sweep, where when checking for something that could possibly be hidden between the crevice of one's buttocks, they swiped their hand between that area. This was done even by the female guards, and this upset and riled the prisoners tremendously. They protested, they caused disturbances. This is something done that's not even done in our own civilian prison systems right here in the U.S. It's called cross-gender searches. We don't even allow that here in the United States. And that was something I was able to get changed, for example, prohibiting women from conducting these types of searches on males.
Mm-hmm. Were these prison guards, were they mostly reservists, or what were they?
When I was down there at the time, most of the guards were reservists. I think there was some National Guard also. None of the military police units. Actually, yes, one of the units was active duty. At least one of the units from Colorado was active. But there were six military police companies down there. It was a mix between active duty, National Guard, and Reserve.
So a lot of them were actually kind of more or less civilians who got called up.
Put it this way, a lot of them were young men and women in their early 20s.
Boy.
At most, who really never had any experience, had much experience of being in positions of authority. And now here they are thrust into a situation where they're given basically complete control over the lives of these prisoners. Perhaps that inexperience led to much of the abuse.
Well, you know, there was that famous experiment at Stanford where some psychology professor took a group of students, divided students into two groups, sort of portraying prisoners and guards. And, you know, they wound up sort of acting out their social roles. The prisoners became rebellious and the guards became very abusive. And it kind of really got away from the experiment that they had to cancel it because these are students who knew they were part of an experiment. They were taking their roles too seriously.
It shows really how far people... the nature of people will go to subject people to cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. I mean, this is really the reason why our legislators, like Senator John McCain, have introduced a bill to prevent any type of treatment or punishment that is cruel, inhuman, or degrading. That's just not who we are as Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you did not... witness any of the interrogations? Did you hear the prisoners talk about them very much?
Much of the reports that have been released, I heard about all of these abuses and allegations when I was down there, much from the prisoners, also some confirmed from other military personnel, translators, sexual tactics being used, female interrogators being provocative, inappropriately touching prisoners, things like that. The abuse to the Quran. There's a confirmed incident from the military's own reports and investigations in which the Quran was thrown on the floor and stepped on, kicked across the floor in efforts to try and break a prisoner. I mean, this abuse towards a holy book is really just unacceptable by any American standard.
Mm-hmm. With this sleep deprivation and things like that.
Right, I do write about some of the things that I observed. Whether or not they actually considered it sleep deprivation is something debatable. But, you know, I wrote about how sometimes prisoners were kept awake at night by the guards, but then in the morning the interrogation and military intelligence people would take over and then subject them to interrogations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was something that you know, could really be looked at.
Who did the interrogations? Were they military people, CIA, or just who was it? Do you know?
For sure, there were military interrogators down there. But we had this term called OGA, other government agencies, and that could have been a number of people. You know, who knows? It could have been the FBI, Defense Intelligence Agency. You know, others. But surely there were military. Army and Navy interrogators, NCIS, and Army military intelligence personnel doing interrogations.
And so what were they, you know, this has been, what, 3 years now, 4 years? And
the first prisoners were brought there, I think, in February, sometime around February 2002. And so some of the prisoners have been there coming on 4 years now.
Uh-huh. Have they been charged with anything?
Or? Most of them have not been charged and are being held indefinitely, not getting any due process.
Mm-hmm.
I believe only nine have been considered chargeable. I believe Something just that handful has actually I've been deemed chargeable and to go before a some kind of tribunal.
Some kind of military panel, actually, then, I guess.
Yeah, they call it commissions.
Yeah. It seemed to me that just being held that long with no idea at all when or if you're going to get out, that's a kind of a torture in itself.
It's really a legal black hole, and this is really one of the main controversies over the whole operation. Much of this is being debated at the highest levels of our courts, of mm-hmm. our judiciary system. The Supreme Court was supposed to have ruled or had accepted to rule on the legality of whether these war crimes tribunals, these commissions that the military set up are even constitutional. They ruled last year that the prisoners do have rights to federal courts to contest their detention, although recent legislation senators had voted to strip habeas corpus rights from prisoners. So a lot of this is being debated by our lawmakers and our highest courts in this land.
Did you hear much from these prisoners about how they were, the circumstances of their capture? Did they say anything about what, if they were doing anything, or what were their stories like?
Well, one of the things that I did initially when I got down there was to clarify what role privileged communication played in my job down there as a Muslim mm-hmm. chaplain. Privileged communication, of course, the idea that conversations are kept confidential between the two people who are conversing. We find it in the attorney privilege, attorney-client privilege. We find it in the doctor-patient relationship. Ensuring that medical records are held confidential, and also we find it in the clergy, a minister, a parishioner type relationship, and that's something that's really held strict in, for example, the religion of or the denomination of Catholicism.
Sure.
We know about the strict confessional that we have, that we know about when people confess their sins to a priest. That's a very strict privileged communication. Initially wanted clarification on this so I wouldn't find myself in any trouble.
Right.
And I queried the Joint Task Force Guantanamo legal officer about this, and she didn't have an answer. She had to ask higher, and she got a word back from the legal officer at the U.S. Southern Command, who said that the prisoners did not have privileged communication with me as the chaplain. Perhaps the view is they don't have rights to privileged communication. Mm-hmm. So I always operated on this assumption to ensure that I myself wouldn't be called forth to testify for or against the military or for or against a prisoner in some type of military tribunal. So I kept away from conversations regarding the circumstances of their capture and whether or not they were engaged in any criminal activity. Mm-hmm. I focused my efforts on what they were doing and how they were doing there at the prison, and in order to help them deal with the stresses of being caged in these camps down at Camp Delta.
Because I've heard reports that some of these prisoners were sort of actually sold by warlords, in Afghanistan. I guess it was a bounty. I mean, these warlords were able to round up people and turn them over to the U.S. Military and say, "Hey, these are terrorists," and they get paid for it.
There were lots of rumors when I was down there about information about that coming out, where people were sold by the Northern Alliance to the American forces for, the going rate of $4,000 or $5,000, which is a pretty good chunk of change for someone living in Afghanistan.
Is there any confirmation of that, or is this what they...
I've actually seen some of this being reported by major news networks. I've seen stuff like this reported on 60 Minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard military personnel, recount some of this information.
Well, let's get on to the troubles that you wound up in. How did that start?
That's a good question. I did learn when I was down there that I was under some type of suspicion and investigation a couple months before even my arrest. And I addressed that to my chain of command, who assured me that I was doing everything above and beyond what was required of me. And then I had received several military awards when I was down there letters of recognition and a great officer evaluation report, the best that I had ever received in the 14 years as a commissioned officer, dated 2 days before my arrest.
Oh.
But, you know, I came into the United States on a short two-week break on September 10th, 2003. And as I came into the air terminal, I was stopped by customs officials who wanted to search my bags. Now, customs officials can do random searches of people coming into the country as part of their role. But I was later find that it was the FBI who requested from customs to identify me, single me out, and search me. And as a result, I was the only one singled out and searched that day. Clearly, this was a violation of my Fourth Amendment constitutional right to be free from an illegal search and seizure. Of course, there was no probable cause. The customs official here acting essentially as an extension of the FBI, a law enforcement agency.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, really, that didn't matter too much because I really didn't have anything. But then it would matter because they would say I had something. They would say I had documents which were suspicious. And then these suspicious documents were taken by customs officials and handed over to the several intelligence officers, both military and federal, who just happened to be standing by. Of course,
yeah.
They weren't happened to be standing by. It was
right.
A sting.
Yeah.
And then these intelligence officers would say that these documents were classified. And once that accusation was made, I was thrown in jail.
Oh. What kind of documents were these, anyway?
Most of what I had were articles printed off right from Yahoo that I was using to help complete my international relations graduate program degree research paper that was due in a couple weeks.
Really? So these are public documents then? I mean,
most of the articles related to this term paper, which I was doing on politics in the Middle East, specifically the country of Syria, where I had done some religious training and had spent before coming back on active duty as a Muslim chaplain.
Well, Syria is kind of a target of the U.S. now for quite a while also. Are there very many Muslim chaplains in the military, do you know?
There's about 10 that are there, and the numbers are decreasing, especially after what happened to me.
Now, this is in the entire military, or what?
Right, this is the Army, Air Force, and the Navy.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know. I mean, I wonder how many Muslim troops there are.
There are those estimates. Those numbers vary in estimates. Official military numbers, I think, range in the 4,000 range. But
mm-hmm.
Other estimates by, for example, Muslim organizations estimate probably 12,000 to 15,000 that are within the ranks.
And there's only 7 or 8 chaplains for them then.
I think they're about 10.
And if they're scattered all around, I mean, be very hard for them to have their needs met, it would seem to me.
This is one of the challenges, getting proper representation of Muslims in the military. You know, my experience and my ordeal really has shown that there's a lot of work that needs to be done within the ranks regarding promoting diversity and tolerance and proper representation of people of the Muslim faith and other minority religions.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish personnel, and other faiths that are not equally represented in the ranks.
Yeah, well, I remember when I was in the Army, you know, Jewish guys didn't have too much access to chaplains, and they had their dietary rules and things like that. They found the so-called
classified documents and
documents.
Threw me in jail.
And then what happened?
And quickly, these allegations were being levied against me that I was engaged in spying, espionage, aiding the enemy, mutiny, and sedition. All four of these allegations or crimes carry the death penalty.
Right, that's pretty serious
stuff. I was actually threatened with the death penalty by the military prosecutor, one of the military legal officers, in a pretrial confinement hearing, which a letter was presented by the commanding general, Major General Jeffrey Miller, who signed off that I was definitively found with classified documents, as well as he made the claim that in my residence in Guantanamo, tickets to London were found. These were both completely false statements, again signed by a two-star general, and that was used to render me a national security risk as well as a flight risk, and I was kept in jail.
So they just made this up out of thin air, as it were.
These were very outlandish allegations that were being made. The disturbing part is a two-star general signed off on this You know, that to me, that calls into question his integrity. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm not the only one who questions his integrity. He's actually the general that was at the center of the Abu Ghraib scandal, in his role in advising how to improve the intelligence gathering shortly before the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq occurred.
All right. He was a general who went from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib then.
Right. And he actually testified in front of the Senate during those hearings, those Abu Ghraib hearings in front of the Senate. And, you know, I read an article in off of MSNBC's website that indicated that one of the ranking House intelligence congresswomen members actually wrote a letter, personal letter, to General Miller questioning his candor when he testified, and that she found information that contradicted his testimony.
So
it's the very same general who locked me up and imprisoned me and brought charges against me.
And so from these documents that you had, which you got off the internet, they resulted in these really dreadful charges. I mean, death penalty charges, treason, you know, that kind of stuff. So what happened then? You were in jail, and you had a series of hearings, or what? Well,
what happened then is they transferred me to a super maximum security prison down in Charleston, South Carolina, the very same prison where the U.S. citizen enemy combatants are being held.
That's where Jose Padilla was.
That's where he is.
He's still
actually
there.
He's supposed to be transferred to a federal prison, but that's been held up for at least 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. citizen enemy combatants are being held in Charleston, the same brig that I was at. The foreign enemy combatants we know are down in Guantanamo. But what's very disturbing and what was very frightening for me was the way in which I was transferred. I was thrown in the back of a truck with an armed guard and two more armed guards in the front seat. On this trip, I was subjected to what's called sensory deprivation. I was already shackled at the wrists, the ankles, and at the waist. And in this trip, the guard pulled out these goggles, painted out black, opaque, put them on my eyes so I couldn't see a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he put on my head these heavy industrial earmuffs, so now I couldn't hear anything.
Right.
We call this sensory deprivation, but I knew about this tactic because I've seen how prisoners, when they're transported from Afghanistan to Guantanamo, under this very same tactic. I was fearing that now I was being treated as an enemy combatant.
And didn't they charge you with... some kind of pornography charges or something like that? I mean, they really went all, it seems to me, they went all out.
They would eventually charge me officially with mishandling classified information and classified documents. The big charges of spying, espionage, aiding the enemy never materialized. And then the day they released me from prison, I'm still under charges, though, they added on additional charges of pornography and having pornography on a government computer and for adultery. They tried to prosecute me criminally for these as well. In the end, all of the charges that were brought against me would not hold up in court, and they all would be dropped. Clearly, the military and the U.S. government carried out a vindictive smear campaign against me to divert attention away from the real issue, that they made this huge mistake in jailing me for 76 days in isolation and accusing me of these heinous death penalty crimes. They wanted to discredit me because they knew about the information I had regarding prisoner abuse and mistreatment.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, this was the intent. It would all backfire. None of it would ever hold up in court. All of the charges would be dropped against me. I would be reinstated as a Muslim chaplain back at Fort Lewis here in Washington State, after which I would resign my commission and receive an honorable discharge in January of this year, as well as receive another Army Commendation Medal.
So when did they start to back down? How did that happen?
They had to back down immediately on the pretrial pretrial hearing. I was still under charges of mishandling classified information, but my attorneys demanded to see an official review of documents that were seized to show that I indeed had classified information.
Mm-hmm.
Disturbingly, a review of these documents had never been initiated. Therefore, the pretrial hearing was delayed again as this review was being conducted. Ultimately, all the charges would be dropped. The hearing would never be resumed because I know that there was never any classified documents. The military has never revealed the results of this review, but I know that it came up negative. And as the Department of Defense Inspector General is currently investigating my case as to how it was that myself, a patriotic West Point graduate serving his country, could land in jail for 76 days under these outlandish charges. That's being investigated, and I hope that that investigation will lead to the disclosure of that review to show that I never had any classified documents.
We can look forward to a report sometime. Any idea when that report might come out?
The military hasn't commented on when it or when that's going to be finished. Of course, myself, my supporters, my family, and several congressmen and senators are interested in seeing that report. And I hope that that leads to a well-deserved apology, not because an apology would right any wrongs. It won't take back those 76 days in isolation or the fact that I was accused of being a terrorist spy and threatened with the death penalty, being separated from my family in secrecy. It won't take back all that, but hopefully an apology would restore some faith in our senior military leadership, which in my case really reflects how poor it is today and is also a reflection of how our military leadership is conducting the current war
on terrorism and
in Iraq.
I think a lot of restoration is needed. So what are you doing now?
I'm very close to finishing that graduate degree. I'm one course away. I should have that done by the end of March. And I, of course, intend to continue to make valuable contributions to the building of this country.
And so you have written this book, For God and Country, and that's available in bookstores, and you are going to be at the Unitarian Church December 13th.
I look forward to my talk and visit.
Uh-huh. Well, we've been talking with Captain James Yee, who is a former Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo, who will be here in town on the 13th of December. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure. Let's do it again sometime.
Okay. I hope so. All right. Okay, this is Per Fargrang. Before I sign off, Kathy Kelly, the founder of Voices in the Wilderness, will be appearing at PSU tonight at the Miller Library and at 7 p.m. And this is a free event, although I think they're hoping that people will bring canned food to donate at the door. Once again, Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness, will be at PSU Miller Library tonight at 7 p.m. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Sounds of Awareness. In this half hour, we discuss the attitudes and biases surrounding people with disabilities and issues relating to employment, housing, education, and integration into all facets of American life. This is Dan Tolva inviting you to join us in this half hour for Sounds of Awareness. Here is your host, Paul Van Dyke.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sounds of Awareness. I'm Paul Van Dyke. Women's health is not necessarily an issue that we normally cover on this program, but I'm going to delve into that a little bit today because we have a rather interesting take on a very difficult subject. When the word menorrhagia was brought to my attention, I thought, well, no, we don't really want to talk about women's menstrual problems and bleeding and that kind of thing. That's really more in the health programs, and there are some women's issue programs on KBOO and on community television that would probably be more adequate for the task. However, it was pointed out to me that this menorrhagia, this excessive menstrual bleeding, can be very disabling for some women who lose time from work, who have difficulties even wanting to go out of their home because they have some rather embarrassing difficulties. So how this particular thing is handled and some solutions to the problem are going to be discussed today on the Sounds of Awareness. My guest today is Dr. George Weghorst. He is an obstetrician, gynecologist, OB-GYN guys they call him, and he's also the medical director at, now correct me if I get this wrong because I'm trying to do this from memory here, for Providence,
Newburgh,
okay. I was thinking the wrong town, Providence Newburgh Hospital. And Dr. Weghorst, thank you for being here and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit, first of all, before we get in actually to the topic, a little bit about the kind of practice that you have and what you do, and maybe a little bit of your background so we can kind of get to know you.
Well, I went to medical school in Texas at the University of Texas, and then did my postgraduate training in obstetrics and gynecology in Southern California at USC, and then came up to Oregon to practice, where I've been in the practice business, so to speak, for 25 years.
Well, so you're not a newcomer to this, or just some guy right out of college. You've had some experience, and I imagine other professions, you read the literature and keep up on things and know some of the new techniques and stuff, right?
Well, a lot has changed in 25 or more years, and that's right. You really need to stay on top of things to know what's working well and what should be discarded. So, been many changes over those years, Paul.
Okay. Well, let's define a little bit that word menorrhagia, because that's basically what we're going to discuss in the remainder of the program. And can you tell our audience, because half of our audience is guys here, so you know, guys, all the jokes and things aside, the menorrhagia is what, the excessive something?
That's correct. It's excessively heavy periods, heavy menstrual function. That's also, there's a term that's a couple more syllables, menometrorrhagia, which means heavy and long. Periods that last more than 7 days, periods that require a woman to change whatever sanitary product they're using more often than once an hour are pretty much
menstrual cycle.
Very good. You
goes along there, and then what are some things that would cause that to go haywire?
Lots of different things. Some of them are tumors or fibroid tumors, sometimes precancerous changes, or even cancer within the uterus, polyps, things of that nature. But more often than not, it's what we call dysfunctional uterine bleeding, which means there isn't a clear, precise reason. It just happens. And it's usually related to the normal hormonal milieu, if you will, the normal hormonal balance that occurs in a woman gets thrown off, so that they're not either not ovulating, or the normal messages that come from the pituitary gland in the brain and go on down to tell the ovary, to tell the uterus to do things. Those messages become very mixed, and as a consequence, the uterus responds inappropriately, and either typically with too much bleeding or sometimes with very little bleeding.
It seems as though
the very obvious point in all of this, and we were talking about the fact that women go through a big fluctuation in their hormonal cycle and all that kind of stuff. Men aren't quite as complicated, are they?
Well, that's correct, Paul. I think in a lot of ways men are quite a bit simpler. But parts of the brain, the hypothalamus to the pituitary gland, they're sending messages down to the ovary to tell the ovary to get ready to release the egg, and those messages are sent on to the uterus in the form of estrogen and things like that. So it's a very dynamic environment, much more so than the male counterpart. And as a consequence, it's very easy for all of those messages to get a little garbled. And there's so many external forces that affect that. Sometimes just stress, weight loss, weight gain, all sorts of things can disturb this very delicate mechanism that most of us just take for granted, but it is very sensitive and easily gone awry.
But you know, that kind of brings me to the point too about menorrhagia being a very disabling condition at times. And in this part of the program, we want to talk about the ways that people can be supportive and helpful. And it's easy as a guy to you know, because we don't go through that kind of stuff and often just don't really give it any thought unless wife is being
careful.
Irritable. I'm careful. I know we're on radio, and I know there are a lot of people are have very strong opinions. Yes. We'll put it that way. But and it's a very delicate thing. And the part where we are here on Sounds of Awareness, again, as I say, bringing this up as a disability issue. Not that it's permanent disability, but if you break your arm, that's not a permanent disability, but that is definitely a disability for you. And so if you're having difficulties with this, it can be terribly disabling. You mentioned that some women actually can't go to work on those days when they're having this. What sorts of things can we do? We're going to talk about the NovaSure thing in a second, but just as guys, what can we do that will be helpful to women when they're going through this stuff?
Well, being sensitive to the fact that it's occurring is certainly a big start and an important part of understanding it. And you're absolutely right, Paul. It's a disability in many ways. And women are disabled. They are unable to work. It's not uncommon for a woman with menorrhagia to miss a day or two of work each day. In some environments, that woman may be treated inappropriately or disrespected because of something that she has no control over, and yet is unable to work, or she comes to work and her menstrual function is so disruptive to her environment that she soils her clothing or whatever, has to go home again. There's all of the emotional components of this also. People, they get up in the morning and are afraid, oh my gosh, this is the worst day that I expect, and gee, what am I going to wear, and am I going to be able to get through work? And it creates an anxiety and a sense of dis-ease. I mean, there's really something from a very personal level of if with your wife or whatever, just be aware that there may be a far more complex dynamic there emotionally than what meets the eye. Just because this is sort of a more or less a regular monthly event, it doesn't mean it should be just brushed aside as nothing.
In the next part of our program, we are going to talk about medical ways to deal with
Menaraja. You're listening and watching Sounds of Awareness on KBOO-FM in Portland and on FBTV Channel 11 here in Vancouver and Clark County. We'll be right back after a break. Back to Sounds of Awareness. Dr. George Winkhorst is my guest, and we are talking about Menaraja and all of the things that, not all, because it's a very complicated deal, but many of the things that can cause it to become a disabling condition. And I know a little bit about some of the treatments. You know, the hysterectomy is probably the thing that comes to a lot of people's mind. But that's a kind of a really heavy-duty procedure. And as we pointed out in the beginning of the program, you've been following up on the latest things to maybe make it not necessary for somebody to have a hysterectomy, and I'm just going to let you go from there, because I don't really know intelligent questions to ask at this point. So,
I'll try to provide intelligent answers.
There you go.
In any case, there are lots of different ways to deal with this extremely common problem. I don't think we haven't thrown a lot of numbers and statistics out, but it does. Menaraja, metroraja, heavy, nasty periods that interfere with the quality of the poop are very, very common. Approximately 10 million people, 10 million women in the United States, suffer from it, and less than half of them seek treatment for any number of reasons, either because they don't know that there's anything to be done or they're just too embarrassed to talk about it. Something on the order of one out of every five visits to a OBGYN office or to a gynecologist's office is related in one manner or another to menorrhagia. I'll give you throw a few more numbers, then we'll stop with the statistics.
Okay.
But about one out of every three or four hysterectomies done in this country, and that amounts, there are 600,000 hysterectomies done in this country every year. One out of three or four of those is done exclusively for heavy, crampy periods. And we have a fairly high incidence of hysterectomy in this country as compared, for example, to Europe.
Now, why would that be?
You know, it's a very good question, and I think it has to do with there are oftentimes not as many options available to us in this country because of the appropriate vigilance and care of the FDA, making sure that nothing is introduced in this country that could cause harm. But, for example, these procedures that we're going to talk about in a few minutes were done, virtually all of the research, the original research, was done in Europe, which is often the case. The hysterectomy rate in women over the age of 60, approximately 40% of those women in the United States will have had a hysterectomy. Same is true for Australia, and yet only 6 or 7% of women in France and Italy. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is what I just said. Also, I'm not sure whether we're less inclined to tolerate inconvenience. We as individuals are less inclined to tolerate inconvenience and hassles and are more inclined to do something about it. The problem is, of course, the doing something, if it involves major surgery like a hysterectomy, it's expensive and carries substantial risks and a lot of recovery time. And that's why these procedures, that, again, we'll talk about in a minute, have been so useful and really should change the way we deal with this common problem.
That being said, let's take a look at the device you brought with you today. This is something you mentioned is made by a company called NovaSure. And while we're not, this again is one of those things where we want to show people about it. This is not an infomercial, and we're not being paid by them. This just happens to be something that you have
worked with and feel it's a good alternative and so on. So I'm going to let you talk a little bit about that. Fact that there are many different approaches to the problem. Paul, you mentioned hysterectomy as sort of the ultimate solution, if you will. But before we get to that point, we're always looking for easier, less invasive ways to take care of things, including sometimes hormones. Birth control pills are the typical thing. And select women, that's exactly what should be done. Certainly women who still want to have children, Women who just have a relatively minor degree of hassle, and women who are comfortable being on hormones. The problem with hormones is they're only effective for as long as you take them, and they carry, I think, some obvious risks that are known to many, most people now. So the first line of treatment is always, as they say, primum non nocere, first do no harm. And so the first thing you want to do is something that's easy and simple. And generally that involves not doing something surgical. But if that fails or if that's not appropriate for that particular patient, then we move on to different kinds of treatments to destroy the lining of the uterus so that the menstrual material cannot be generated, and therefore there will not be a menstrual period.
Okay.
So that's where we're close to this particular instrument now. And in interest of not being an infomercial, there are many different. In fact, there are five different ways to accomplish the task in what is called global endometrial ablation techniques. This one, I've done many of these. In fact, I've done. A lot of the ones that preceded these technologies, which were something called a rollerball and things of that nature, that are very difficult to do and require a lot of surgical skill and are fraught with side effects. So the second generation devices, the NovaSure device being my favorite, and the others that have really made a profound difference in the safety and efficacy or effectiveness of dealing with this condition without having to revert to a hysterectomy. Now, I'm giving you more information or your listeners more information than they want, but the various techniques include a device that freezes the inside of the uterus that still fundamentally does the same thing, that is, destroys the manufacturing level of the lining.
That would be cryo something, right?
That's right. That's a cryo instrument. There's a circulating hot water instrument. There's another instrument that is a hot water balloon. And there's another instrument that puts out microwaves. And then there's the NovaSure device. And it's just in my hands, and I think in most, but not necessarily all clinicians, that this device has the best blend of safety and efficiency. And
to Sounds of Awareness with host Paul Van Dyke and guest Dr. George Weghorst. Sorry about that program. There were numerous technical difficulties with that, and so we're going to hear music here until Democracy Now! Comes to you at 11 a.m. is KBOO Portland. It's 11 o'clock.